Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
There's a professor at Vanderbilt named Michael Bess who worries a lot about a trend he sees coming. It's our increasing ability to change our bodies. And I'm not talking about small changes here, like a nose job or a tattoo. We're talking about major, invasive, sometimes genetic changes to the way we look and the way we think. Bess has written a book about what he sees happening. And he says he used to believe that the talk of genetically modifying babies to make them good at sports or to change their eye color was ridiculous. Parents wouldn't want to fiddle with their kids before they were even born.
It's almost like putting them onto rails that you're sort of preempting many different possibilities, the openness of the development of a person. And I think some parents may feel comfortable doing that, but I think many would not. But there's a new domain of genetics that's in the past 5 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, has become increasingly exciting for biologists, and that's epigenetics. Epigenetic changes could be made at any point in a person's lifetime. And so you don't have the same issue of parents sort of forcing their children into a certain mold long before those children have become adults who can make choices for themselves. You can say, we can start making epigenetic changes after you're 21 years old. And then you can become sort of a genetic work in progress, sculpting your appearance, but also aspects of your personality and character over time. Epigenetic changes do not alter the underlying DNA, but they are the molecular mechanisms that affect how the DNA gets expressed or doesn't get expressed.
Okay, give me a sense of how this works, because it's really hard to conceptualize. I mean, I look a certain way, right? That's already, as far as I can tell, that's already sort of baked into the cake. How possibly, once I'm already born and maybe even I'm already grown up, how do I then start to fiddle with that and say, well, I don't actually want to look exactly this way? Or what kinds of things could you change?
Well, in a physical level, I'll take myself as an example. I really like to eat, and so I have a tendency to put on weight. So I'm constantly having to struggle and, you know, go on diets and stuff, and then I eat, and then I go back on diets, and that's, you know, I'm not alone in this. Now imagine that there were an epigenetic pathway that allowed me to alter the way I metabolize food so that my metabolism is ratcheted up in certain ways or altered in certain ways, and I end up being able to eat whatever I want, as long as it's, you know, not just pure fat that's going to, you know, cause me to get very unhealthy, but eat whatever I want and not put on weight. That would be one example of an epigenetic modification. It's a small enhancement, but it nonetheless would affect the way I behave and in some ways the way I look.
Right. To dip back into that issue of designer babies for a second, how far off do you think we actually are from a point where parents will alter their children? I mean, probably with the best of intentions, just to kind of give them a leg up in the world. Because it seems like human nature to, you know, within your ability, help your kids out. And if that means making them a couple inches taller, that's probably what parents are going to try to do.
That's right. And they won't be able to make sure that it happens, but they'll probably within the next decade be able to start intervening in ways that increase the probability of it happening.
And do you think the government is going to allow that to happen, like to increase the probability that you're going to have, you know, a kid that's taller?
Well, I mean, the government will have to respond to what the majority of the population decides is ethical. And as long as the proper animal trials have been run and, you know, the side effects are recognized and are acceptable. Let's say, for example, that you discovered that a certain type of trout had a genetic ability to fend off cancer. That strikes me as the sort of alteration that many parents would be willing to make in their children at the moment of conception if such a technology became possible, because you're not worrying then about what am I doing to the personality of my child. You're just giving them an immunity or a greater resistance to a terrible disease. And I think many parents would opt for that, just like vaccinations. That's the type of designer baby that I think is likely to become. Maybe 10 years is too soon. Maybe it's going to take 20 years or 25 years.
That still seems pretty soon.
That still seems pretty soon, especially compared to what we were thinking as recently as a decade or two ago.
Right.
And that could become a reality. And I don't see the government preventing that sort of thing. But obviously, if the parents are trying to make their kids into geniuses, and first of all, we don't fully understand, you know, all those mechanisms. In fact, we're still very far from fully understanding what intelligence exactly is, how it gets created in the brain, how the interaction between genes and environment contributes. But having said that, I keep being struck by how far we've already come and how rapidly the changes are taking place. In the 12 years that I've been following this closely, I keep being astonished by things that I thought were far away that are actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a constant experience of mine, which I guess brings me to the underlying message of the book, which is this is going to be tantalizing stuff. The temptation, the pressure is going to be great to go faster and faster and for people to try to adopt these things as quickly as they can. And my worry is that if we go too quickly and millions of people are adopting these kinds of modifications, there could be some terrible social, societal level effects.
Let's think through some of those effects. In some ways, the positive ramifications to somebody having a kid that's smarter or taller or can't get cancer is clear. But what are some of the more hidden effects or negative effects that we may not think about?
The metaphor I always use is the automobile. When you just take an automobile by itself, it's a fantastic technology that lets you go all over the place and increases your range of motion. And so as by itself, it's terrific. But then you look at what happens when millions of people adopt it, and you get sort of the evisceration of our cities as people move out to the suburbs. You get diseases spreading more quickly. You get traffic jams. You get dependency on foreign oil. You get pollution. All these unintended effects that happen when it becomes adopted at a mass scale. The same types of things can be expected to happen if millions of people start adopting a wide variety of these kinds of modifications, pharmaceutical, bioelectronic, epigenetic. The first thing that comes to mind is how expensive will they be, and will they only be accessible? Will the most potent modifications only be accessible to the wealthy?
Right.
Because then you start to say, well, if that's the case, then this will grievously exacerbate the gap between the haves and the have-nots in our society.
Well, you have almost a biological then splintering of the haves and the have-nots instead of just a monetary splintering, which you can always reverse monetary situations, but biology's harder to change.
That's right, much harder. So that suddenly the range of possibilities open to some people will be exponentially greater than the range of possibilities open to others. And that's even more troublesome when you look at it on a global scale. Because within a society like the United States, that's a relatively wealthy society, we have tremendous disparities of wealth, but there's a greater degree of social mobility, at least compared to other parts of the world. But when you look at it on a global scale, then it becomes even more frightening. And I worry about that.
She bought me. Tim mentioned the advanced research that our medical system is known for, and it's kind of mind-boggling how we can have such an advanced system and still have a problem with infant mortality in this country. The U.S. has a rate of about 6 infant deaths for every 1,000 live births. That's more than twice as high as the infant mortality rate in Japan or Finland, for example. And that's despite a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control that signaled a small reduction in infant mortality here. So why are we still lagging behind so many other nations? Emily Oster is an associate professor at Brown University who studied infant mortality.
So I think it's difficult to tell. So what we find in our paper is that, yes, indeed, you know, well-off women in the U.S. have similar mortality rates to women elsewhere, and that really what's going on in the data is that poor women in the U.S., particularly in the period between 1 and 12 months of life, so the period when the infant is at home and where a lot of deaths are occurring in the home, that's the group and the time period that really drives a lot of our high infant mortality rates. There are a lot of explanations for that. And one possibility is differences in healthcare access. Another possibility is differences in maternity leave, differences in other kinds of resources. And all of these things may play an important role.
So tell us what other countries are doing right, not just for wealthy women, but for all women across the board, especially if the U.S. is lagging behind in last place of 27 wealthy countries.
So I'll give you one example of something that struck us that's very different between the U.S. and most countries in Europe, which is most places in Europe have universal home visiting programs. So when you go home with your baby, somebody comes to your house, typically more than one time, and they see how things are going and they help you with things that you're struggling with and they give you advice. There's a little bit of that in the U.S. and it's become more common, but it's certainly not as uniform as it is elsewhere. And I think that many people cite that as an important difference in terms of the infrastructure and the help that women are getting after they're home with their babies, not so much in the hospital, but once you're at home and trying to figure out how to do things right.
You're saying that's for women all across the board, like in other countries in Europe. I mean, poor women, they also get longer maternity leave, for example.
Yeah, there are many things that are different across the board. And I think one of the things that goes on is that wealthy women have a lot of ways in the U.S. to get support that is not accessible to poor women. And elsewhere, there's more uniformity in the kinds of help that people are getting. And there's less inequality in general. And that probably plays an important role.
You know, it's crazy. I was just in Kenya for 2 weeks and we were doing a story about getting women to prenatal visits using incentives like, you know, sweet potatoes, orange flesh sweet potatoes. It almost sounds like for some women in the United States, we need to have a similar program here.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting people in for more prenatal visits is crucial. And I think it's not so much about incentives, but about making it easy, making it accessible, making it something you don't have to sit and wait for, you know, 5 hours in a clinic to see somebody. We want to make those things really easy.
So you mentioned the home visiting programs, which sounds, gosh, kind of luxurious. What else are poor U.S. pregnant mothers missing here that they might get, say, if they lived in Sweden or somewhere in Europe?
They are getting fewer prenatal visits. Why exactly that's true, I think, is unclear. In many of these other countries, you get gifts. The government will send you, like in Finland, which is one of the countries we study, the government sends you this box of stuff. And it's like clothes and diapers and so on. Obviously, we're not doing that here. Does that really matter? I think it's hard to tell. And I think that this is so wrapped up in a lot of other issues of poverty and inequality. It's hard to point to a particular behavior and say, aha, this is the thing that's going to make a difference.
As you've studied this, have you seen any inclination in this country to really having a comprehensive healthcare program from conception all the way through those postnatal months?
I think there are pushes in this direction. I mean, in terms of the medical care during pregnancy and, you know, during the birth, you know, Medicaid covers poor women. In terms of postnatal stuff, as I said, I think that there's a push towards trying to have more support postnatally, but that is still really getting off the ground. And that's something that a lot of people are working on, but not in a uniform way.
Emily Oster, who is at Brown University just down the road from us in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I know about white people, too. Like when they talk, they say the whole word like this.
English is everywhere, and where it isn't, parts of the world where English isn't, people want to learn it, or they want their kids to learn it. Like in South Korea, there are more than 20,000 ESL, English as a Second Language teachers who are working in South Korea.
20,000.
20,000. Some of them are employed in the public school system, and a lot of them teach at these private academies.
Like sort of cram schools for English, that kind
right,
of thing?
Right, right. Huh. Most of these people, I think nearly all of these teachers are native English speakers. They're from all over the English-speaking world. But when it comes to exactly where they're from in the English-speaking world, there's a huge pecking order.
I'm guessing here that American English is king.
Well, that's what we asked Jason Strother to find out.
South Korean law only allows nationals from seven English-speaking countries, including Ireland, South Africa, and Australia, to teach ESL.
What takes its place?
Cool air.
Yes, cool air.
But some teachers who aren't from the U.S. or Canada say schools won't hire instructors with their accents. I've heard that some bosses will even tell non-North Americans to fake an American accent in the classroom. Many South Koreans prefer the American accent over others because of their country's historical and cultural ties with the United States, says Jasper Kim, who lectures at Seoul's Ewha Women's University. He says this preference fulfills an academic objective, too.
Well, I think for many South Koreans, having the American accent means it's the right path. And so the American accent is a ticket to get the children to where they want them to be, which is, in essence, the Ivy Leagues. Anything else just wouldn't make sense to many, but not all Koreans. So that's why there's a preference for the American accent.
Some tutoring schools in Seoul specifically advertise they teach North American English.
So you've been living in Seoul for how many years now?
9 years.
Do you get compliments on your own American English? Do people want you to teach their kids how to speak properly?
You know, on occasion, Patrick, I do get compliments, especially from people who perhaps are not fluent English speakers. I've been told, oh, wow, your English is so good, and I like the sound of your voice. Fortunately, no one has asked me to teach their kids. I mean, there is a certain degree that I'm a Caucasian foreigner here in Korea. People automatically assume that I'm an English teacher, since probably the majority of Western expats here are in the English teaching profession. But once I tell them that that's not my game, they usually leave me alone.
You know, the director of the language school that you spoke to, I was struck by his comment that it doesn't matter what kind of accent you have. I mean, I wonder how many Koreans agree with him and how many would still think that it really matters a lot.
Yeah, I was quite surprised what Mr. Kang said as well. I was expecting, when I arrived at his school, and that's located in the Gangnam district of Seoul, for him to tell me how important it was for his students to speak American English. But his view was much more nuanced, perhaps because he has a background in linguistics.
The Gangnam district of Seoul, is that the same district that...
That is
Gangnam style,
Patrick.
Right?
That is Gangnam style all the way. I mean, that is where the most expensive hagwons, these private academies, are located. It's the area of town that all Koreans aspire to live in or work in and study in to an extent. I talked with a lawyer, actually, who works with English teachers in discrimination cases, and he said this doesn't happen so much in Seoul these days, but it's the smaller schools outside of this big cities where there still is this preference, a strong preference, for American-accented English. There's still a belief in these, let's say, less affluent, less populated areas that if you're going to learn English, you better learn it the American way. And it's not only for the sake of learning the language. Koreans, from the time they're in elementary school until they're, you know, well set in their careers, they're being assessed again and again on how well they speak English. And Jasper Kim, who you heard in my piece, a professor at Seoul's Ewha Women's University, he says it can be quite superficial.
English education is not just for practical reasons. It's viewed as a signal that you are from the right family, from the right economic class. If you're able to speak English fairly well, fluently, then that means that your family's had the economic resources to send you to the United States or to send you to England, as opposed to other places. I think it's just the image that conjures up by many South Koreans, especially South Korean mothers, when you think about what is America, what does it represent? And often that's what is found in their living rooms through television and cable and Hollywood, the Brad Pitts, Leonardo DiCaprio's. And so they want an image that fulfills sort of their idea of what it's like to live the American life. And so when there can be someone who teaches at a Hagwon, which is trying to fulfill educational but also economic objectives, then hiring someone who looks like that can be probably more beneficial than others who don't look like that.
So when he says look like that or don't look like that, what does he mean? Does he mean look like a white American?
That's exactly what he means, Patrick. For instance, I was talking with one of the teachers at the school that I featured. He's a Korean-American guy. He speaks both Korean and English, but he told me when he first arrived here in Korea a few years back looking for an English teaching job, he was turned down because he didn't look the part. A lot of schools, and again, smaller schools, probably outside of Seoul more likely, their ideal teacher is someone who looks American, and that is a fair-skinned, perhaps light-eyed and light-haired Westerner, and Asian-Americans, African-Americans, Latino-Americans, they don't fit that picture.
And is it okay to say that? Is that how socially acceptable is it to speak quite boldly about race?
It's getting less and less acceptable here. When I first arrived here, I actually did a story about the preference for white English teachers. I remember interviewing an African-American guy from Philadelphia who was told flat out by the school, one of these private Hagwons, one of these private institutes outside of Seoul, saying, sorry, we can't hire a black guy. The parents wouldn't feel comfortable having their kids taught by a black person. It still happens, although it's much more on the hush. And I'm teachers that I've spoke to, recruiters who I've spoke to. Bosses will give every other excuse in the world for not hiring someone who isn't white. But, you know, when it comes down to it, that's what they're actually looking for.
Here's a different type of police problem. Being able to figure out when someone is driving while stoned. There's pressure to find a reliable way to do that in the areas of the U.S. that have legalized recreational marijuana. Washington State is one of them. And a lab at Washington State University is working to develop a roadside marijuana breathalyzer. Reporter Tom Bonsi of the Northwest News Network paid a visit.
Let's suppose for just a second that you smoked a couple joints at a party and then got behind the wheel. This could be you.
I'm Lieutenant Sharp of the State Patrol. The reason I stopped you today is I noticed you weren't able to stay in your lane. Any reason for that?
That's Washington State Patrol Lieutenant Rob Sharp. He says driving behavior, coordination, odors, mannerisms, and physical cues are some of the factors he uses to establish impairment by drugs.
Okay, sir, what I need you to do right now is turn around and put your hands behind your back. You're under arrest for DUI.
If this were real, the arresting officer might take you in for an hour-long evaluation by a drug recognition expert. He could seek a warrant to have your blood drawn at a hospital. The blood work typically takes weeks to come back. Washington State University chemistry professor Herb Hill heard about the challenges of nabbing drug-impaired drivers during a chance encounter with a colleague at a reception.
And I said, well, why don't we have a breathalyzer for that? And then he says, well, there's none exists. And I said, well, I think we can probably make one.
And ta-da! Well, actually, it's taken years. But the goal is in sight. Hill takes me to his lab, where he and colleagues are developing a handheld device that police officers can use to detect THC in breath. THC is the main psychoactive compound in marijuana.
This is the new prototype here.
So this is version 2.0?
This is 2.0.
Okay. Hill says preliminary field testing with 30 human subjects this spring established that the device can detect THC in breath. Much more testing is ahead to look at potential variations among gender, race, body types, and chronic users. Some marijuana activists fear this technology could lead to unimpaired drivers getting unfairly arrested. They point out that THC persists in the body long after the high has worn off. Hill's team recruits volunteers who buy their own weed and smoke it at their homes and then blow into the prototype.
We had to go through the human testing, the institutional board review, and it took us almost a year to get permission to do this.
How hard was it to find these volunteers?
It wasn't very hard to find the volunteers. We have a waiting list of volunteers.
The human guinea pigs get paid just over minimum wage to smoke their pot. Hill says the portable device he's developing may look like an alcohol breathalyzer, but works differently inside. His team is modifying existing explosive detectors and chemical warfare sensors.
In the beginning, at least, this would not be used as evidential information. It would be used as screening information.
The Washington State Patrol's Lieutenant Sharp says he's excited by the prospect of new tools to help him do his job better, but he says the pot breathalyzer must prove itself highly accurate before he'd adopt it.
Even if it's a preliminary device, we still need that level of accuracy and reliability for the trust and confidence. We're talking about people's rights, their liberties and freedoms.
All of which points to it being several years at the earliest before you'd see a roadside breath test to identify stoned drivers. A few states have set legal limits for THC, but most have not. For NPR News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
Now on the squad call, CPR's supposed to be the motto, but in their minds, they be like, yo, I'ma do Diallo.
An NYPD promotion is bringing one of the city's most tragic moments back into the news. Officer Kenneth Boss was promoted to sergeant yesterday. He was one of four officers who shot and killed Amadou Diallo in 1999. Despite firing 41 shots, they were acquitted of murder and other charges. They said they thought Diallo had a gun, but the 23-year-old was reaching for his wallet. Boss has been with the department for 21 years and was the only one to stay on the force after the shooting. Diallo's mother, Kadiatou Diallo, is speaking out about the promotion and joins us now. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
How did you feel when you heard the news that Officer Boss was being promoted?
I felt that it was devastating, and I expressed myself since yesterday to let the world know that this was shocking to me and I disagree with the decision, because I believe an officer who has been empowered with his weapon and has killed an innocent person like Amadou was killed should not have his gun back and do the same work.
Do you feel that this promotion of Officer Boss, now Sergeant Boss, somehow means that Amadou's death was in vain?
This decision sends the wrong signal to the community. As a mother, I do not want my son's death to be in vain, as you said. And how I'm going to work and build his legacy is through the Amadou Diallo Foundation. The mission of the Amadou Diallo Foundation is to promote dialogue and discussion around the nation and bring people together so that we can promote racial healing and police and community relations.
The NYPD says that Officer Boss had to clear a lot of hurdles before this promotion. He went years without a weapon. His record was reviewed carefully and extensively, given what had happened, and he did have to pass the civil service exam. What's your response to that?
Four police officers were responsible of killing Amadou, and one of them has insisted to carry his, to get his gun back and to look for promotions while he's fighting hard to get back his gun and be promoted. I am fighting hard to rebuild my life. I think that if we consider transparency and reform through the criminal justice system, we have to come to the term of no one is above the law. They have to answer to that crime.
Each time these stories burst into the headlines, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, too many to name here, over the course of the last almost 17 years since Amadou Diallo was shot, it must cause you great pain and agony. We've had the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement. So much has happened. So much has not happened in that interval. At the same time, we've had the shooting deaths of officers Wenjian Liu and Rafael Ramos 1 year ago this Sunday. What do you think has to happen to improve police-community relations?
When people attack police officers, that cannot help the situation. For me, I want to be the one who can pull those two worlds together, because in the end, the community will not live without law enforcement. And law enforcement should not be the jury, the judge, and the executioner of those young people. I think a whole generation now, rightly or wrongly, they are feeling that they've been targeted. And that kind of feelings need to be changed.
Katiadou Diallo is the mother of Amadou Diallo. She is also president of the Amadou Diallo Foundation, which will have its first benefit on February 4th to commemorate the 17th anniversary of her son's death. Katiadou Diallo, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to be a cop.
Police officers speaking out against fellow officers who they say have used racial slurs against them, bringing their complaints to town hall. The Night Team's Nick Emmons live in Brookline with what happened when the officers showed up to a town hall meeting tonight. Nick?
Yeah, Adam, it was supposed to be a routine meeting here at Brookline Town Hall, but instead of a full agenda, the Board of Selectmen had a room full of protesters.
All those in favor of granting the temporary license.
Tense moments at a Brookline board meeting.
This is how you treat people of color in your town?
Community members demanding answers from the Board of Selectmen after allegations of racism within the police department.
This isn't a safe environment anymore for minorities.
Officer Estefano Sarai says he's experienced racism firsthand.
I was in an unmarked cruiser when a lieutenant walked by me, and when I said, "Hi, Lieutenant, how are you?" He said, "Who would put a black man behind one of these?"
Fellow officer Prentice Pilot says he had an incident with another officer this month after he put in for a new position.
And the next thing out of his mouth was, "Why don't you pull the corner of the car up on the curb, go up on the sidewalk, do some jumping jacks, and I'll put in a good word for you."
When community members tried to get answers to those allegations from the board,
"I will not be taking any public comment on this matter."
Their concerns fell on deaf ears.
"I am not recognizing you."
The board said no one signed up to speak, so they walked out. Talking to empty seats, community members voiced their support for the officers.
"We are asking you to put these officers on paid leave while you put your house in order."
The board chairman did read a statement prior to walking out.
"Any employee who's found responsible for such conduct will be swiftly and appropriately disciplined."
Now, the board said that because this is an ongoing investigation, they can't comment much more than that. The town said they did bring in someone from outside of the city to look into these multiple allegations, while the police department also has hired a consultant. That's the latest live in Brookline. Nick Emmons, 7 News 19.
Play, ain't no black people in Minnesota.
On one of the busiest shopping and travel days of the year, hundreds of Black Lives Matter protesters gathered at the Mall of America today, and then they took trains to the airport. They briefly blocked the road heading into the airport, and a handful were arrested. Reporters Tim Nelson and Reham Fashir covered today's demonstrations, and both join me now live from the Mall of America. Good to have you both.
Hi, Tom.
So first, let's start with Tim. You were inside the mall with the protesters. Tell us what happened there.
Well, people started to gather about 1 o'clock, and they crowded the rotunda beneath a giant sign that said the demonstration was unauthorized and telling people to leave if they were protesting. Now, the actual protest was very brief. A few people started pulling out like handmade signs printed on copy paper, and within 5 minutes, a lot of them started to file out of the rotunda and out the east door. And, you know, Tom, it was kind of eerie. They were virtually silent with their fists in the air as they walked out, although there was some chanting. Now, there were dozens of police in riot helmets that moved in to push the stragglers out the door and warn them they were risking arrest. The mall had told retailers to close their doors about 12:45, and about 80 of them did, but it was mostly limited to the area around the rotunda and the east wing of the mall. Just a few minutes ago now, the mall issued a statement and said there were only 4 arrests. Now, that's far fewer than last year.
Now, Reham, once the protesters left the Mall of America, you followed them to the airport. Take us on that leg of the demonstration this afternoon and tell us what happened.
Yeah, as the protesters walked out of the mall, they headed to the light rail station just outside. They gathered briefly, chanted, and rallied. Then a couple of the leaders of the group encouraged everyone to get on the train. They wouldn't announce what their strategy was or where they were headed, but a couple of stops later, they arrived at Terminal 2. Once everyone arrived, the train service shut down, and protesters began filling the stairwell to the terminal. Police blocked everyone from getting inside the terminal. Except some of them kept going to Terminal 1, where, again, they couldn't get inside, but a small group of them blocked the access road from Highway 5. And there were dozens of airport police and state troopers in riot gear telling protesters to get on the train or risk getting arrested. We're told just a few minutes ago by airport officials that there may have been 10 people arrested at the airport today.
So, Tim, what do we know about the protesters' strategy today?
Well, you know, they didn't really say anything. They have been very mum about that all along during this week. And, you know, as I said, this protest was virtually silent inside the mall. If you weren't looking very carefully, you might not have known what was going on, although it certainly drew a lot of attention. There were hundreds of people watching and media from around the country. Later, Black Lives Matter Minneapolis said the protest was a success because it disrupted business at the Mall of America, at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and Blue Line Light Rail Service.
And Reham, do you think that protesters achieved what they set out to do today?
They did get a lot of attention and also defied that legal challenge by the Mall of America to keep them out. They also extended their presence to the airport and the light rail, but they're still demanding release of the videotape in the Jamar Clark officer-involved shooting, as well as a special prosecutor and more serious charges in connection with the shooting outside of the Minneapolis 4th Precinct last month.
At the Mall of America, what was the reaction from shoppers there? Because I imagine, Tim Nelson, it's probably the busiest day or one of them of the year there, right?
Well, it wasn't particularly busy. I've been out here recent weekends, and it's been much busier. But it is a Wednesday afternoon. Yeah. You know, people were pretty calm. It was a little surprising how many people stopped and asked what was going on and seemed sort of confused about why the stores were closing. You know, the biggest issue I saw were the many, many people that were trying to use the transit from the mall, and the trains and buses just stopped coming. I don't think anyone expected that. But, you know, I just came out of the mall a few minutes ago, and everything is back open, and the shoppers are back in the stores, and it looks like things are back to normal.
And, Reham, you were at the airport just quickly. Things back to normal there with check-in and all of that, as far as you know?
Right. As far as I know, right before I left, there were a few more arrests being made at the on the platform outside of the terminal. But maybe about an hour ago, things started to go back to normal.
Tim Nelson and Reham Fashir both reporting from the Mall of America for us tonight, covering today's protests in both places. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, Tom.
When you're a cop, you can torment free the Simi Valley, then seize the Audi, then beam proudly, turn a routine traffic stop to your season finale when you're a cop.
Family members and supporters are demanding justice for Sandra Bland after a grand jury failed to indict anyone for her death. Bland, a 28-year-old African-American woman, was arrested on July 10th when a traffic stop escalated into a confrontation with the officer involved. 3 days later, her body was found hanging from a trash bag inside her jail cell. Authorities say she killed herself, a claim her family rejects. They've also questioned why Bland was arrested and jailed in the first place and why she was kept behind bars for so long.
Sandra Bland had recently moved to Texas to start a job at Prairie View A&M University, her alma mater. She was driving near campus when Texas State Trooper Brian Encinia pulled her over and accused her of failing to signal a lane change. Police dash cam video that captured part of the arrest shows Encinia threatening to forcibly remove Bland from her car.
Sandra Bland was jailed and given $5,000 bond. 3 days later, she was found dead in her cell in the Waller County Jail in Texas. On Monday, a Texas grand jury rejected charges in connection with her death, although prison officers wouldn't face charges. Encinia could still be indicted when the grand jury reconvenes next month. Special prosecutor Darryl Jordan said the case remains open.
It has been a very, very long day for us as well as the grand jury. After presenting all the evidence as it relates to the death of Sandra Bland, the grand jury did not return an indictment. The grand jury also considered things that occurred at the jail and did not return an indictment. There are other issues that the grand jury is still considering. And they will take up those issues when we return next month.
Bland's family is calling for charges against Encinia when the grand jury reconvenes. A wrongful death suit by the family names Encinia, along with two Waller County jail guards, the Texas Department of Public Safety, and Waller County. The family has also criticized the secrecy of the grand jury, whose deliberations are sealed. On Tuesday, protesters marched outside the Waller County Courthouse and in Houston to call on the Justice Department to bring federal charges against the officers involved. Sandra Bland is one of many African Americans whose death in police custody has galvanized the nation's Black Lives Matter movement and sparked demands for structural change in how police treat people of color. Well, the family of Sandra Bland is here now to talk about the case. We will be joined by her sister in a moment, but we are joined now by Geneva Reed Veal, who is Sandra Bland's mother. And we're joined by Cannon Lambert, the attorney representing Sandra Bland's family. Let's go first to Geneva Reed Veal. Your response to the grand jury yesterday saying that they would not indict anyone in relation to Sandra's death in the Waller County Jail.
I'm disappointed, but not surprised. I just have to say right now that we were looking for transparency. And that's not what we have been experiencing in this whole journey here. So I'm, again, disappointed but not surprised.
And Cannon Lambert, as the attorney for the family, your response to this recent development?
Well, frankly, I think you have to first understand what it is that a grand jury does and what it is in general. A grand jury is nothing more than an appendage or a tool of the prosecutor. What they do many times is that they'll convene a grand jury for the purposes of then saying, well, look, we submitted evidence to a grand jury. They assess that evidence, and then they come back and they realize that there's no reason for there to be an indictment. But in reality, those secretive proceedings are shrouded with problems and shrouded with misconception. The bottom line is that you don't know what evidence is being submitted. The prosecutor acts as the judge. There is no judge that actually oversees the proceeding. The prosecutor, gets to cherry-pick whatever evidence they want to submit and then withhold whatever evidence they want to withhold. So they get to pick what it is that they want to present. And then thereafter, they're able to even go into using hearsay when they want to, unlike in ordinary judicial proceedings and the like. So we're not even allowed to be present, right? We're not allowed to test any of the evidence that they offer. We're not allowed to offer any evidence ourselves. So there's a whole big problem with what it is that grand juries do in the first place. But over and above that, the problem that I have in this particular case with this grand jury is that the five special prosecutors that were supposed to appoint, that were appointed by the DA of Waller County, they were supposed to be looking at this from the standpoint of assessing it as a homicide, according to Elton Mathis. But the lead special prosecutor, Paul Looney, 2 months ago in a Huffington Post ad article, he indicated they were not looking at Waller County to determine whether or not they had done anything criminal. But instead, they were just looking prospectively to see if there was something they could do to suggest changes that they might make in the future. They didn't look at this from the standpoint of trying to establish whether or not there was anything criminally done. And so as a consequence, we find ourselves feeling very uncomfortable about this whole process.
Sharon Cooper, if you, too, could respond to the decision by the grand jury. Now, it's not over. The case of Brian Encinia, the officer who first stopped Sandra, has not been weighed by the grand jury yet. But the actual, those responsible for her death in the jail cell have not been indicted.
It is, I definitely would like to echo my mother's sentiment in terms of, I would say, just from a sibling's perspective, and being a surviving member of something as tragic as this, I will tell you that it is disappointing and it's heart-wrenching, but at the same time, not surprising, given the fact that we are guided by excellent legal counsel and felt that we were a bit prepared for this to be the case in light of the lack of participation and transparency that we have received from the DA's office in this case, as well as the opposing side in general. I will tell you that I'm not all that hopeful that there will be charges brought against Officer Encinia, because in the 5 months since Sandy's passing, the dash cam video was made readily available days after we went to Texas for the first time. And so there is unequivocally no doubt that Officer Encinia performed in an unprofessional way and that his conduct was gross at best. And so I'm not sure how much more time the other side needs to how much clearer it can be for the other side. So I'm not hopeful that he will even be indicted on charges. And I personally believe that it is a travesty, because I do believe that the stop in his behavior was the impetus for Sandy's detainment, and ultimately the reason why she's no longer here with us today.
And before we get to the officer's action, I wanted to ask Hannon Lambert about the investigation about the death of Sandra Bland in the cell. You've raised questions about the evidence, how the evidence was preserved, about whether proper fingerprinting was done of the bag in which she was found. Could you talk about that as well?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that they say that they did is they did a thorough investigation. Well, I have difficulty with that notion, because if you do a thorough investigation and you follow the directives of the DA, like what was supposedly suggested, that you were going to address this as a homicide, you at the very least would take fingerprints of the instrument of death. The plastic bag, as we understand it, has not been even fingerprinted. Well, how can you suggest that you did an independent and thorough investigation when you haven't even fingerprinted the instrument of death? So how is it that a grand jury is going to get evidence that they can make a real decision from? I mean, that's exactly the problem that you have, right? It's an example of how whatever evidence they want to submit, they'll submit. If they want an indictment, they get an indictment.
I wanted to ask about the prosecutor and what he has said, Prosecutor Darryl Jordan. He said, when I see them on the news, he's talking—this was a quote that he gave to the Chicago Sun-Times, and he's talking about you all, the family of Sandra Bland. When I see them on the news stating they've been left out of the process, that's not because of us. We're begging to talk to the Bland family. We're begging to answer any questions that they have. I've never heard of a criminal case where the prosecutor did not talk to the victim's family. Any parent deserves to know anything out there that relates to the death of their child. Can you tell us what your allegations are in terms of the lack of communications with the prosecutor, Geneva Reedville?
I have had no communication with the prosecutor. I am not privy to anything other than an initial contact very early on in this proceeding. And I will have to let Cannon, my attorney, speak to that, because he was the one that handled that.
Let's be very, very, very clear. As soon as Mr. Jordan was appointed as a special prosecutor, he contacted us. We were in Houston while he was traveling on a personal family excursion to Indianapolis. He asked if he could meet us the following day. I told him that we were unable to do that because we were going to still be in Houston, but that we were happy to do so. Just let us know when he'd like to do that. He never again contacted us. Now, he is the investigator. He knows his process. He knows his schedule. I asked him in that one conversation, well, what are you investigating? Who are you looking at? And the like. Those are the questions that this family has. If he's serious about what he said about any family should have answers to questions that they have about their loved one, well, why wouldn't he answer those questions? I can tell you he didn't. I'll also tell you that we never again heard from him until after they came back with their determination that there was no indictment to be had. And so now he goes on TV and he suggests that this is when they'd love to talk to the family. You want to talk to the family after you've decided that there's no indictment that's necessary or that's appropriate. That's crazy.
How did you learn of the non-indictment? How did you learn of the non-indictment?
Through the media. ABC 13 in Houston contacted me by way of text and let me know. And it was 15 minutes or so after that that I got a text message from Mr. Jordan. And that was the second time that I had been in contact with him. So the bottom line is that, frankly speaking, when you do an investigation or when you're trying to make a determination, you first have to do your investigation. You don't make a determination and then backdoor the investigation.
I wanted to ask about Officer Insignia's actions. Sharon Cooper, you mentioned his unprofessional conduct in the original arrest, because obviously your sister would never have been in jail had he not arrested her and had the confrontation he had with her. This whole issue of whether the officer even reported on his official incident report exactly what happened. What do you know about that? Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, and it's another great example of very basic information that we don't have. This incident happened on Friday, July 10th. We are 2 days out from Christmas, and we still don't have the initial police report that Brian Insignia would have authored after this incident to memorialize all that transpired. What I can tell you is, based off of what we've seen on the dash cam video, and although it's painful to watch, I think it's imperative to watch it frame by frame so that you can see exactly the improper behavior that took place by Officer Insignia. I think it's important to note that he clearly states to Sandy that he's going to give her a warning, or that he was going to give her a warning, and there was a seismic shift in his behavior when he asked her, not demanded of her, not lawfully ordered of her, but asked her to put her cigarette out, to which she replied, "Why do I have to put my cigarette out? Because I'm in my own vehicle." So it was at that point that he escalates, not de-escalates the situation. And so although we don't have an actual police report, what I can tell you is if you look at that tape closely and you zero in what he's calling in to his superiors, he flat out lies about what transpired at the stop. He says that he tried to de-escalate the situation. He says, "I don't know why she got so upset. I never told her she was under arrest." He told her she was under arrest after she said to him, "I don't have to get out of my car. Am I under arrest?" And he says, "Yes, you are." She asked him 14 times why she was under arrest and received no response. So it's the dash cam video coupled with the strength of the bystander video, which shows the use of Officer Insignia's continual excessive force after he yanked Sandy out of the vehicle and even pulled his taser and threatened to light her up.
Now, after she's arrested and she's in jail, she faces $5,000 bond. Cannon Lambert, have you ever had this explained, why she faced a $5,000 bond if the charge was not signaling a lane change? Cannon
Lambert.
I'll
say this to you. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I'll say this to you. The bottom line is that when the bail is set, it's predicated on what the charge is. Mm-hmm. And the falsification that Mr. Insignia engaged in was the impetus behind that bail being set in the way that it was. And so we go back again, we find ourselves at least having to go back again to the stop. When he lied about what he did, he also lied about what she did. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason why she ends up in jail. So, you know, look, they're saying right now that they still need to go and reconvene back in January. And I'm asking myself the same, you know, sort of questions that Sharon mentions. All of the evidence that they need as to what Brian Insignia's conduct was is right on tape. And they've had that videotape for 5 months. What other investigation is there to do?
Can you talk about the civil suit and the kind of evidence and information you're able to gather for that civil suit and where it stands?
Well, the problem with the civil suit is that right now we're kind of we're in a holding pattern. One of the things that we've been trying to get from the very inception is the Texas Ranger report. The Texas Ranger report includes all of the witness statements that were taken, all of the evidence that was gathered. It constitutes where all of the information regarding what Sandy's state was when she was first found. It will let us know if the individuals involved who found her took body temperatures, whether or not they gauged her rigor and Liger conditions, those sorts of things, so that we'll be able to determine the date and time of her death. The whole nine yards is going to be enclosed in that Texas Ranger report. Well, the problem is that we've not been able to get the Texas Ranger report. Sharon mentions the initial police report. That's one of the things that will be mentioned and will be contained in that Texas Ranger report. We can't get that right now because the defendants have—they've been claiming that there's a criminal proceeding that's taking place, namely the grand jury. Well, the grand jury now has made its decision. I'm specifically asking that Daryl Jordan, when he decides that he wants to address the media, that he speak to the fact that there is no reason that the release of the Texas Ranger report would impede the remainder of what it is that the grand jury has to do. All he's got to do is make that reference and make it clear, because that is the situation and everybody knows it. If he makes that representation, then there's no reason why we can't get the Texas Ranger report, and therefore no reason we can't continue to move forward in the civil action.
I wanted to ask Mr. Lambert the issue of what you're calling for in terms of federal intervention at this point by the federal government.
Yeah, the reason we're asking for federal intervention is because, number one, the DA, Elton Mathis, is the one that appointed the five special prosecutors that were supposed to be investigating this situation. And if you remember back, they were saying that they had full and complete access to all of the evidence and that they had subpoena power and the like. Well, part of the problem with regard to Mr. Looney and Mr. Mathis's relationship is that there is, it seems that it's not independent. And so when you don't have an independent examination of all of the evidence, and when you have the leader of that special prosecutorial group saying, we're not looking to determine whether or not there were any criminal actions that were engaged in by the Waller County Police, then you have to ask for outside eyes to look at this situation, because from the very outset, it appears they never had any intention of trying to determine what happened in that jail.
It's been a number of months, about half a year, since Sandra Bland was killed. And Geneva Reed-Veal, your thoughts now as we move into this holiday season, how you're coping and the response that you've gotten to Sandy's death?
I'm coping right now day to day. I'm coping as best as I can as a mother. And I will say to you that anyone who has to openly grieve in this manner, it's a tough thing to do, but you learn how to go on day by day, just saying to yourself, you have to continue to get justice for your child. For me right now, 6 months almost later, dealing with more questions than I had before, and not being able to have anything, access to anything, it makes it very hard to move forward when you have an open window, a cloud over your head of what really happened. So at this point, I'm still saying, what happened to Sandra Bland? I cannot be expected to believe what I've not been able to receive as evidence as it pertains to what has happened to my daughter. And that's what I am being asked to do in some cases by great lengths of folks. You have people who are totally supportive of the family that I am grateful for. I am grateful for those people because they will show the world that this is a problem. There is a problem here. And the fact that it's continuing to be talked about over Twitter, over the internet, social media, there is a problem that exists that people want an answer to. People want a fix to this situation. And so being a parent and watching all of this and knowing that my daughter's death has reignited grave concerns, it's awesome. I have to tell you, just the support is overwhelming. And I can't even begin to say thank you enough to those who still stand in the gap, to those who still go out, to those who still talk about Sandy's life, death. Every day, there's something out there about her case every day. And it's great to see that people are still aware, regardless of the lack of evidence that's been shown to us and the world, really. People are still aware and people are still keeping up with this because they want to know what happened.
And Ken and Lambert, why we're talking about the grand jury reconvening in the case of Officer Encinia now? Usually, if a person is involved with an assault or there is a question, an arraignment happens within days. Now, granted, this is a police officer, but what—can you explain the order of how this is being investigated?
Well, I wish I could, but it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality of it is that I don't believe that police should be treated any better or any worse, frankly, than any other citizen when it comes down to when you break the law and you should be held accountable, whether you wear a badge or not. So the bottom line is that when we look at what this situation really before us is, it's a situation where you can clearly see that an unlawful order was issued, that he used excessive force, that he falsified his reports. He illegally searched and violated her Fourth Amendment rights, and he should be held to account. So when it comes down to why it is that they're seeming to say they need more time to assess what his conduct was, I will be frank with you. I think we are all flabbergasted by that. It does not make sense. That's the easiest part of this entire situation to assess because it's caught on tape.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Cannon Lambert, family attorney, Sharon Cooper, Sandy's sister, and Geneva Reed Veal, the mother of Sandra Bland.
Remembering a man known as the father of the civil rights movement in St. Augustine.
Dr. Robert Haling passed away Sunday. He was 86 years old. His efforts in St. Augustine led to the passing of the Civil Rights Act that shaped the nation. Channel 4's Crystal Moyer spoke to Haling's close friend about his legacy.
Discrimination, segregation, and inequality will always be a part of American history, but the memories of Dr. Robert Haling will also live there as a prominent civil rights leader whose courage changed everything.
We had some great moments as he now transitioned into glory, but we who are left here are here to tell the story.
Tony Hill served as a Florida senator and knew Haling for many years. He considers him a good friend.
He would sign his name, and at the end, he would always say, never give up. Very humble, very approachable.
And Haling never gave up on his quest for equality. In 1960, Haling moved to St. Augustine, opening up his own dental practice. He organized and participated in numerous organizations and protests for social change. He and a few other activists were even beaten during a KKK rally.
He went to a Klan meeting, and they got caught. And they broke all his knuckles. They're going to say, we're going to make sure this guy don't never practice anymore.
It wasn't until 1964 that St. Augustine took the world stage. Black and white swimmers jumped into a hotel's pool to protest its whites-only policy. Now, that protest was part of a nonviolent youth movement organized by Haling.
The iconic moment was when they went to go get into that swimming pool and they got poured acid.
Word spread like wildfire after this picture of the disturbing scene was shared. Haling also reached out to other prominent civil rights leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It ultimately led to the passing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Throughout his life, Haling would be recognized for his role as a civil rights leader. We were there as he was inducted into the Florida Civil Rights Hall of Fame.
When he received that award that day, it was so powerful. He said when he was a little boy, he used to mow the grass up here. He couldn't even come in the building. And now y'all honor me here in this building today. And so that to me was a momentous occasion.
Hill says he will share his memories of Haling with anyone who will listen in hopes of continuing his work and legacy. Crystal Moyer, Channel 4, the local station.
Tired of funerals. Tired of it. Got to stand up.
A look back now at one of the most shocking events of 2015. It happened on a warm June night in South Carolina.
At 9:05 this evening, we received a call of a a shooting that had occurred at the church here on Calhoun Street.
That's Police Chief Gregory Mullen talking about the murder of 9 people, all African-American, at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. They were gathered that evening for Bible study. A young white man sat with them for a while and then opened fire. He later told authorities that he wanted to start a race war.
Reverend DePayne Middleton was among those killed, and we want to take a moment now to remember her. She was 49 years old, a mother to 4 daughters, and cousin to Reverend Waltrina Middleton of Cleveland, Ohio.
Our cousins, our cohort of cousins, we grew up as siblings.
Also as neighbors and schoolmates and friends. DePayne was 10 years older, but Waltrina Middleton says they were as close as sisters.
It's been difficult for me to even look at her photo. I reflect on times that we've spent together, like after school, sitting on her parents' front porch, and she would talk to me about what happened in the school day or help me work through my adolescent problems. I hold on to those conversations that we had. Just those precious, intimate moments of sisterhood. I mean, she bought me my first bra. you know, things like that. Growing up with DePayne was kind of intimidating almost because she was a perfectionist. She was very popular. She excelled academically. She was also a successful athlete. She was the queen of our high school.
When you say the queen, do you mean figuratively or actually like she was the homecoming queen?
She was the homecoming queen, but she was also Miss Baptist Ohio. There was always this high expectation when you went to the middle school, to the high school. Oh, you're a Middleton. You're DePayne's cousin or relative.
Well, if that's what she was like as a kid, what kind of adult, what kind of a parent, what kind of a reverend did she grow up to be?
Well, we call her Dep, and Dep had great passion and dedication to everything. And so family was everything to her. She loved her children. And you can see her children, they are DePayne Middleton with the go-getter energy, the drive and the determination. Wonderful, like from the pit of your belly laughter to the very quiet, charming personality, the desire to protect each other and one another. That's who they are. Looking back at even growing up, because there were times when I wanted to be angry with her or her sister or one of my other cousins or my siblings. And she was that voice of reason that would challenge us when we would get into arguments and fights. And I'm very thankful for that, because that lesson that she instilled in us is definitely something that's giving us strength today.
I wonder, did your cousin DePayne have a turn of phrase or something she said a lot that sticks in your mind?
Well, I mean, I can't think of a particular phrase, but she had an infectious laughter. I can't even describe it. It's just really deep, awkward laugh.
Awkward. Awkward is not the word I would have expected you to use.
We often teased one another, and we assigned Sesame Street characters to one another.
Oh, really?
I can't reveal which is which.
Well, now that you've said you assigned Sesame Street characters to one another, I have to ask.
I can't. Like, I would be in so much trouble.
Okay, we will let you keep that little family secret then.
But yeah, I mean, I think the heart of who she was to hold on to our faith and to love our family passionately, unconditionally, and unapologetically.
Reverend Middleton, I'd like to read you something that you wrote shortly after the shooting. You quoted C.S. Lewis, who said, "It is easy to say you believe a rope to be strong and sound as long as you are merely using it to cord a box." And then you wrote, "But suppose your life depended on that invisible rope that is your faith. Today, the weight of that invisible rope tugs at my trembling heart." How strong did you discover that rope of faith to be?
I'm still discovering it. One thing that I know about my family is that we are a family of faith, and I can't generalize what faith means for my entire family. But for me, it is having hope and faith in that unseen, and it truly was tested. I'm still working through holding on to that rope, that invisible rope, and trusting in that unseen, because I'm still here somehow. I wasn't really sure how we were going to live beyond the reality of confirming that Depp was one of those persons in the church basement. And yet we're still here. So there's something we're holding on to. There's something we're standing upon. And when I look at her parents and see how they wake up each day, her sisters, and see how they make it through each day, there's nothing else that I can point to other than there being a God that's holding us up, because there's no other explanation for still being here.
That's Reverend Waltrina Middleton. Her cousin, the Reverend DePayne Middleton, was killed during a shooting at a church in Charleston in June of this year. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 26th, 2015. So I have been told a compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing views from victims of white supremacy, non-white people. If you have commentary on the audio clips that we heard at the beginning, your own observations, there were certainly many other things that happened over the last 7 days or so with the so-called holidays and all that good stuff. We'll get to workplace racism towards the end of the program, but feel free, chime in. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A few quick things before we get to folks that dialed in so you all can share. The program yesterday, again, we had major technical difficulties. I think all of it was beyond my control. I even did my best to subvert some of it when I saw it early on was going to be a problem, but still ended up having difficulties. But the archives should be uploaded, should have been uploaded a long time ago, but should be pristine for folks who were trying to listen in. If you missed some of the portions or wasn't clear, just had a difficult time, should be up, should be at iTunes as well, or on the Black Talk Radio Network. You can check it out and be all set to roll for next Friday for the fourth installment. The half has never been told, but thanks for the folks who were patient and hung in with us yesterday, and hopefully we will be good to go moving forward. Next, the report at the end about Sandra Bland, that was from Democracy Now!, where they talked about suspected race soldier Brian Encinia. That's the white male who arrested Sandra Bland. They have the dash cam video, and I think it was another civilian who also had video footage as well. But I thought it was interesting in that report, or beyond interesting, when they said that they still did not have his police report on the arrest of Sandra Bland. And that stood out because I think, and this is, you know, something that's very important to me, we should really be striving for accuracy. The system of white supremacy is primarily driven by deception. So you have a lot of inaccurate things that are said, and really white people make a lot. They get black people, they get non-white people a lot in just pushing inaccurate, incorrect information. So we really want to strive for accuracy. But, and I checked, I spent time trying to find it. The situation in Ferguson with Michael Brown when he was shot and killed last summer, and Darren Wilson, I think it was the exact same thing where there was no initial police report about what happened, where he didn't, Darren Wilson, where he didn't file the report. Like I said, I looked and I couldn't find it. So this is not one that I'm, you know, giving down that this is the gospel and you take my word for it. But I would encourage folks to look, I would encourage folks to investigate for yourself, or if people remember, because I think that was a point of contention in the same case. I just think that's important because it shows that this is another aspect of these killings that is a pattern where they go back with the paperwork, the way that they're going to use words in being deceptive, where they don't even file proper documentation about what happened. Just putting that out because I think that's super important, along with some many other things with that incident. Also thought it was important, well, just with Amy Goodman, I have talked about her repeatedly down through the years. My views, that's another suspected race soldier on what she does at Democracy Now. But she called Sandra Bland on a first name basis. And that was one of those I just have to have white people sitting around and talking like we're cool and buddies and friends. Just, oh, man, that it turned my stomach. The report where they were talking, about, it was in South Korea, they were talking about language, English as a second language is one of the first reports that we played. I thought it was really important. It reminded me, folks who've been listening to the Cows for a number of years, we had a black male on the program from South Korea. He had an incident. He was thrown off of a bus when they called him all kinds of nigger and all this, and these were not white people, these were so-called South Koreans, non-white people, so-called Asians, but he was thrown off the bus and he came on the program. Really, I mean, just profound bit of sharing that he did when he was back. This was like autumn of 2011, but he said it was 365 days of racism. I think he went there for that specific purpose, to teach English. And he said, just, you know, them looking at him as a black person, like, oh, what are you doing here, you nigger, and rah, rah, rah. And he talked about it for the whole program. But that was one of the first things that came to mind in that whole segment, which I thought was fascinating for many reasons. Not in the audio segments, but still with the anti-blackness. I'm sure a lot of our listeners were around different non-white people throughout the course of this week and the holidays and all that stuff. And, you know, maybe you got, hopefully you got an opportunity to spend some constructive time with family members, friends, people that you care about, and did not have any conflict. That's great. I was hanging out. I was around other non-white people, and I'm just noting some of the times I didn't have my headphones on. So I wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was engaged and I'm sitting around, we're having, you know, great conversation and all that. I was kind of in and out paying attention, but I was just listening. And I was like, wow, this is a lot of negative commentary, like talking bad about the non-white people and, you know, just not pleasant, not a lot of nice things to say. And at one point I said, man, I was talking to one non-white person, victim of racism. I'm talking to one person specifically. And I said, man, you know, you just said nasty things all day long. Like, I haven't heard you say anything positive, anything constructive about any other non-white people. Like, can you remember one positive thing that you said this morning? And the person, that victim, actually stopped and thought about it. And they said, well, I don't remember. But I'm sure I did say something positive, and you don't remember because you're so stupid. I looked and I was like, you see, that's all I could say. And at that point, I think someone voted. They were like, well, maybe we should just not have any communication at all. And I said, amen, I vote for that too. And I turned the volume up on my headphones. But that is the system of white supremacy, rife with just conflict and being nasty with other victims of racism. It is widely encouraged, celebrated, promoted, and we should really try to do all that we can to stop that and to not feed into it, because I think a lot of times when that happens, just the instinct is to say something nasty back, and then it just goes, you know. Anyway, moving forward. Last thing I'll get in before we move forward. I didn't have anything in the audio about this. I know a lot of people, there was a lot of tension, I think, with the holidays on big movies and all that. If people go to the movies, that's an easy one that we could curtail in terms of talking about economics and just steps to counter racism. We don't do movies. Like, man, black people are just, no, we do not do movies. We don't go to the movies. We don't do cable. None of that stuff. As long as the system of white supremacy exists, not shelling out our nickels to go see a lot of anti-black filth, not Star Wars, not nothing. In that vein, for the people who still feel that, you know, you want to see these films, you want a little entertainment to take a break, or you want to study, or you have an interest in whatever the topic that's going to be covered in a particular movie or what have you, a lot of that stuff is available online, easily available online. I took time this week, I guess it was after the program we had with Tanzila Ahmed, that was on Tuesday. I had a free moment. I looked, I had seen all this publicity for Concussion, and I thought that this would relate to racism, white supremacy, as everything does. So I said, let me look and see if it's online. I didn't invest a whole lot of time. This was not anything where I did any sleuthing and searching for everything. I took maybe 2 minutes and, oh, there it is. Found like a DVD quality version. I didn't even know at the time that I watched it. I don't even think the film was out in theaters yet. I might be incorrect about that. But if it is, it just came out. Anyway, so I found like DVD quality version. So I watched it. I'm like, wow, this is so interesting. The racism is just layers of racism, white supremacy all throughout. I played the sound clip before from Hotel Rwanda where Nick Nolte, where he says, what's his line? It's info. I've played the sound clip. Oh, he says, you're not even a nigger. You're an African. And I thought they were going to say that verbatim in Concussion because the main character, Will Smith, the guy that Will Smith is playing, he is a quote unquote African, black person, not born in the States, born on the continent. And he's talking to a white guy, and the white guy is allegedly on his side, like, yeah, you need to get this information out. And these concussions is terrible. These players, you know, they're really suffering. And he's telling him, like, the NFL, they don't want to talk to you. They don't want to hear. They don't care about your research. And he says, you're not even an African-American. And he just starts snickering. I was like, oh, is he going to say it? But they didn't care it out the whole way. But the layers of racism, I mean, it's obvious. You have lots and lots. Most of the NFL is black players. So they're going to be the ones that are really suffering from this brain damage and these lasting injuries. And brain deficiencies as a result of playing this, you know, really violent, barbaric game. But there was one scene where they had a retired black player and he was talking to a black executive. I think he was a retired player too, but he's talking to this NFL executive and they're having an argument. The retired player is saying, you know, I'm struggling. I don't have any money. I'm having a really tough time. Can you help me out? I'm having these health problems. And this is like out on the street too. This is not in the office or somewhere. This is just out, you know, like you bump into someone on the side of the street or what have you. So they're having this conversation and it ends up getting really heated. And they're arguing and the retired player at one point, he says, man, he grabs him like by the collar and is shaking like, man, I can't believe you. You're not helping me. You're no good sellout. And I'm like, wow. I go check out because there are a lot of articles on this and even a lot of articles that are bringing out the racism in all of this, right? The concussions in the NFL. But I checked one of the articles and this is based on a real black person that committed suicide and his family, they said that they watched this and they were really upset about the way that their deceased loved one was portrayed in the film. I'll get you his exact name in a second, but they were really upset about the way he was portrayed in the film. And they said, this scene didn't even happen. Like they just made this up out of whole cloth. Like, what was the point of making up this scene where you have these two black guys arguing out on the street and him calling him a sellout and all this? Why did you even put that in the film? That never happened. That was not, you know, the way that he was. Yes, he had problems and what have you. But, you know, they felt that they had really done a disservice in the way that he was characterized. And I just said, wow, yet again. The evidence of white people, they promote that. They are the ones that sit back. Yes, he's a coon. He's a sellout. Yes, that's the way you need to think about it. They promote that. That supports their system of white supremacy, racism, to have us fighting with one another, blaming one another, name-calling one another. I thought that was really, really important. And I'm really, really glad that his family got that out there, put that out in public, that this didn't even happen. They just fabricated a whole scene of anti-blackness, you know, just for whatever, in my opinion, because it supports the system of white supremacy. But they can say for entertainment value or whatever, they felt that this was important for whatever reason. But I did think that that was significant. Not that I'm plugging anybody to go to the movies to see this film or anything else that might be at your local theater this week, next year, anytime while the system of white supremacy exists. We will pause there and let folks share if they have thoughts they would like to get in. This is not the entertainment version, so if you saw Star Wars and you want to talk about that, we can maybe do that another day. But we're not doing entertainment, and we're not doing Area 8 on the Saturday call-in. If you'd like to dial in, feel free. Just watch the background noise. Really help that. Keeps the distortion down. If you use the vote line, that's great. It's free. I encourage folks to use it, particularly if you're outside the states. Just it would be helpful if you maybe could use headphones. That helps keep down some of the echoing, like if you have it on speakerphone, the way that you have your computer sound configured, really would be helpful if you have headphones just to keep down some of the extra noise and what have you when I open your line up. But if you can watch the background noise and just be mindful that there are other people who would like to share, so you can be concise, so that you don't take all day sharing. Make sure everybody gets an opportunity to share. You can share one time and then allow everybody else to make sure they get in one turn. And then if you have extra comments that you want to get in or questions or anything else, we should have time for that too before we get to workplace racism. Right on. That said, everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, guys. Good evening, everyone. I'm really sorry about the no indictment for Ms. Bland. And, I just do the regular things that I do. I went to the courthouse and I just watched. So at least I know they're being watched. And I can tell you the grand jury, which can go up to 12 people, had 11 people. Six of them were white women. They had one black man who showed up 2 hours late and looked like he just came off the ranch. It's like they called him and said, you got to show up. They had two white men. They had one mixed race man that people said he's unsure of what his designation is. And then they had one black female who everybody said, oh, I didn't recognize her. She's wearing a wig, so I think she was in disguise. But anyway, it was just a lot of white women, and you could look at them and tell they never talked to a black person in their life. So the grand jury is just, they were not going to get anything out of that. And besides this DA, I mean, he is known for selective prosecution. It's just something we're going to have to deal with and in deselecting him. But I just don't see him ever, you know, bringing charges against anyone who even has a white card for, you know, harming a black person. Actually, what I saw gave me some concern, because what I saw was the last witness who went in there was Officer Penny Good, the black police officer who escorted Miss Bland to the jail. She was the last person in, and she is also the officer who stood by while the councilman was tased. So I'm thinking they're probably going to try and blame everything on the black female police officer, Officer Penny Good. And the chances of them doing that would be better, except for Brian Insignia is, you know, he's not completely white. So they may give him a slap on the wrist. But I'm thinking they're going to really try to make Officer Good stand in for both of those assaults by white people, you know, practicing racism. That's a shame. That's a shame. But, you know, she's not been of any value to us at this time at all. So, oh, and the other thing that was really strange is they had five special prosecutors calling themselves special prosecutors. Now, they are not special prosecutor. A special prosecutor is an impartial attorney that you bring in. And all of these guys just live down the road. They just live next door. You know, they've worked for Waller County in the past in one capacity or another, and they're not getting paid. So it's not like it's a job for them to do and do correctly. They're just doing a favor for a buddy. None of them are getting paid. So it's not like you can call them a special prosecutor. So, and the other thing is while they were in there interacting with the grand jury, no one else is supposed to be in there. But that DA was in and out, in and out, in and out. That is not the way it's supposed to work. Either they are representing the DA as a special prosecutor, or the DA is in there representing the DA as his own prosecutor. So that right there was probably some kind of felonious thing. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. But, I mean, my condolences again to the Bland family for all the mistreatment that her daughter endured and for her death and everything. And we are not finished, and I pay attention to everything forever. So, anyway, that was all I observed about the grand jury.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to all. Good evening, Gus. Thomas Smith from New York. Had a few comments to make off the clip. First, I wanted to say, man, that first clip messed me up, Gus. Man, I could have had some white kids, man. GMO babies, man. If they let parents choose the color of their kids' skin, that's going to be your next level stuff, man. I don't see too many blacks wanting to bring in the next Mike Brown or Trayvon or Tamir Rice. You know, when they could bring in a Dylan Roof, you know. I think that this has been around for a while because I'm watching the NBA, and these light-skinned brothers is playing ball these days. Like, I'm like, man, they got one white parent, and they could jump out to children. It's crazy. The language barrier piece amongst Asians, I guess, is huge. I don't know. I hate to say it, but if I lived in Korea and somebody was coming to teach me English, I would probably want a white person too. But next time a white person comes on the show and says, you know, oh, the system's not global. The system's not global. It's not in Asia. It's not in Japan. It's not in China. It's not in Korea. Yeah, right. Okay. I think that kind of, well, so many reasons why you could say that, that disproves it, but that's one of them. You're just crumbling herb piece. Man, that breathalyzer sounds like it's no joke, man. When they legalize marijuana, and they will, I would say, man, don't drive, okay? Because that just sounds like it's really, man, it could go back for days probably. I mean, it's just how are they going to be able to know that you just smoked? I mean, that's a game changer. It also, I mean, I can't wait for the people to start selling the gum, you know, chew this gum right before you get pulled over. That's going to be a big deal. Amadou Diallo, man, I remember that. And I think the cops asked him for ID, and he went to grab it, and they shot him up. I mean, when you're a street vendor, you usually have to have a license and be able to show ID to the cops to prove that, you know, you have paid your dues and got the right authorization to do that. And, you know, I just remember that happening and just feeling so shocked. And I wish I had the knowledge I have now, because it would have been like just another shooting, you know. I would have, you know, but I really internalized that when that happened, because I mean, we were really upset, and it was like a couple of his doorsmen right after that. It was a few, like three, right back to back to back. One of the guys was shot in the back of the head in the Bronx, fleeing from the cops. He said they found a gun on him, but he was shot in the back of the head. And being that he had a gun and drugs on him, it was never really investigated like Diallo, like Amadou and Dorsman was. But, and I remember that. The grand jury, I think we learned from previous shows and clips that if the prosecution wants to indict someone in a grand jury, you know, they it's pretty easy to do. And in this case, they have five special prosecutors. So that meant that, you know, no one was really going hard trying to get an indictment here. And I don't have much hope going forward for them, because if she died in jail in police custody and they got off not killing her, then what are you going to do to the cop? I mean, all he's going to say is, well, I put her in jail. I didn't kill her. I mean, as expected under the system of white supremacy, but I hope that the family sounded like they were so optimistic. I just think they're setting themselves up for a failure there. You know, I always say white validation is the highest addicted drug in the planet. It's the most contagious disease on the planet. And you played that clip with the civil rights leader. And that clip, man, I tell you, I really just don't like the civil rights movement. And that clip pointed out exactly why. And, you know, I think that civil rights leaders had a highest level of white validation. They deal it and they spread it around. And it's very, like I said, it's contagious and addictive. And, you know, I just, you know, when I hear that they passed, you know, I feel sad. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, hopefully we could change this ideology of integration and get out of that spell they put us in. And I'll mute my line.
Just one correction. The family, I think they did in that clip, they did say that they did not, they were not hopeful that suspected racist Encinia would be indicted. It seemed like they didn't seem very confused about what was going on and potential, what, you know, the potential for justice happening for the folks who are responsible for her, Sandra Bland's death. They did say that they were not hopeful.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to the host. Good evening to the listeners. Just wanted to share, I can attest to the whole ESL teaching story in Korea. I had the experience of teaching in China. I am identified as a Black female. And at one point, I was tutoring a young child, a toddler. And so when his father actually came home early one day and saw that I was Black, I lost my job. I also had an experience where I interviewed for Scholastics in China. And at one point, of course, they didn't hire me, but at some point they had to actually put their tail in between their legs. I apologize for using a metaphor. And they actually came and they called me and wanted to hire me. But at that point, I was working and I was like, no, I'm not going to work for you. You could have hired me the first go around. Regarding the last story on the shooting, just going over the shooting that happened at the Charleston church, I'm still surprised that the victims, the relatives of the victims, continue to talk to the white media. I'm going to just put this out there in the universe. I'm just hoping that Black people would get a clue and they would go and start talking more to the Black media. And so if white people want to know our stories, if they want to know about how we feel, if they want to know our opinions, go to the Black media if you want to really hear about what we think and how we feel. And the last point, I don't know if anyone heard. This is pop culture and also music. The singer, white British singer Josh Stone, was actually awarded Best Reggae Artist of 2015 by Billboard magazine for her reggae-inspired album called Water for My Soul. I think the title of the album is pretty interesting. And supposedly it's because she sold the most albums, the most quote-unquote reggae albums. And the album is just full of collaborations with very prominent reggae singers, including A. Marley. I'm going to put my phone on mute and I'll contribute later to workplace racism. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So I've been thinking about the Sandra Bland case and how it's resurfaced in the media and Black people's hope for justice under this white supremacist structure. So we keep talking about how the law is supposed to hold these police officers accountable, but it seems to me that as Black people, we fail to recognize that the police is fundamentally protected under this law. I mean, it's historical. Police have stemmed out of slave patrolling, and also you see it with the Black Hoods, how police has been taught how to treat blacks throughout history. So the law is fundamentally racist, and I think it needs to be revised, and if necessary, actually it is utmost necessary that it is dismantled and restructured. But I think we need to get black people to recognize first that we need to interrogate the law and critically analyze how it's not built to protect us. So I just wanted to ask you, do you think we can ever achieve justice under this white supremacist justice system? Gus, what are your thoughts on this?
I think the way Mr. Fuller is known for saying it is replace white supremacy with justice. I think as long as this system is in place, the laws are used to support, strengthen, promote white supremacy. I just don't think it's going to be possible for correct things to happen for non-white people, particularly black people. Or even redressive grievances. If something wrong does happen and you try to, what they say, let the courts handle it, let the law handle it, I just don't think that that's going to work out to our benefit. And I think there should be enough evidence at this point, because we've been trying to do this for a long time, and saying, well, hey, we'll go through the courts and let them handle it. You can go all the way back to Robert F. Williams in North Carolina, where he said the same thing, let's try and go through the courts and let them handle it. And it just doesn't work out in our favor. So I think we have to just go about the work of understanding that and replacing this system in order to establish justice, because nothing about this is designed for justice, correctness for non-white people, particularly black people.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Could I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. On the issue of the Charleston Nine that was murdered, I think that was a good idea, like you said, if they didn't speak to any white media. I never thought about it like that. That kind of gave me a new outlook, so I'm glad I tuned in to hear that point of view. Probably that's all I had to say about those two situations. Another thing would probably be a personal one, what I have experienced over the holidays. A lot of my grandmother's generation, they're passing off, And, a lot of the land that they had, they passing it on to the generations that's under them. And, we have some property that's like 82 acres, something around there. But it's been in our family since the turn of the century, around the 1900s. You see what I'm saying? And it was purchased by a former slave, my great-granddaddy's granddaddy. I don't know his name. I can probably go back as my great-granddaddy. But I know that's where it come from. But anyway, they sold that piece to a Caucasian. And, like I said, since my adulthood, I've been going down there shooting guns since I turned 21. You see what I'm saying? So I always go down there and shoot guns. You're in the middle of the woods, nobody around there. So it's really, people go down there and hunt, things like that. And I'm on my property, so I'm bothering no one. It's never been a problem. But now, since they sold it to that Caucasian, I was down there the other day shooting my guns as usual, and the Caucasian left his property that my cousin sold him all the way up the street, probably like a half a mile or a little bit better up the road. And he come riding all the way down the road on the golf cart. And when he pulled up in my yard, he got an AK-47 on his back, asking me what I'm doing on my property. Who am I? He might just saw him the property probably like 2-3 weeks ago. My cousin. My cousin just sold the property about 2-3 weeks ago. And I told her before they sold me the property, I said, you know what's going to happen? I said, you're going to sell that property to some Caucasians, and they're going to come down there thinking they ruling things, and somebody going to get hurt down there. And already, now, somebody come roll. Now, I'm not on his property. I'm on mine.
and he come rolling up on my property with an AK-47. And luckily, I had somebody else with me. You know, it could have got very bad. I knew he was going to do that. And I asked my friend to come with me. And my buddy came with me. And I said, I know when I go down there on my property shooting guns like I have been doing all my life, and this Caucasian who just bought that going to come down there with some foolishness. And that's all I wanted to say. I also got something to share for the first time that I never shared in workplace racism ever in my life, because I go through workplace racism, but I usually don't talk about it. I waited for something serious to happen. It happened 4 months ago, but I got all the legal issues out of the way, and I got the video footage and everything of what happened. But I go over that later on. I'll mute my line.
Hello?
Greetings, M1. We can hear you.
Hey. I believe there may have been some feedback issues a couple of weeks ago. I just wanted to apologize for that. Anyway, I just wanted to give a shout-out to Brittany Stafford. She is the wife of Louisiana black police officer Derek Stafford. I just want to give a shout out for engaging in black self-respect. She is recently interviewed. If we remember, her husband Derek Stafford, as well as Norris Greenhouse, were the two Louisiana cops that shot and killed a little white boy and wounded his dad, and they were quickly arrested, prosecuted, and all of that. She stated that the shooting was an accident, but her husband and her partner would not have been charged if they were white. And I just thought that was really great, you know, particularly when you media, people that run media love to promote this unity between black married couples. So it was good to see her stick up for her husband and to point out the obvious racism in her husband being charged. She had stated this during a bond hearing. She wanted the bond lowered to $150,000. The judge said, no, it's staying at $1 million. Now, if you remember, I pointed out there's not going to be any Darren Wilson money coming to him or his partner, Norris Greenhouse, but all police officers belong to a union. And they all must pay union dues. So she should ask, where is the defense fund coming from his union? Considering that police unions, as I said, do have large coffers. See that? Why aren't they springing for his bail? That's all I want to say, but Brittany Stafford, black wife, self-respect. I love it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to you guys and all the callers and listeners. I wanted to speak on the Charleston church shooting, because I just read an article that said that they're going to be spending millions of dollars to preserve the Confederate flag that was flying on the South Carolina State Capitol, to preserve it and to place it in the Civil War Museum. Again, to me, it's just the worship of white supremacy. They're going to preserve this artifact and essentially commemorate the murder of 9 people for white people to go visit and pay homage to Dylan Storm Roof. So I just wanted to just speak on that for a moment. And then also my condolences to the Bland family as well for the loss of their daughter. And, of course, no charges being filed in the situation as far as them seeking to get some justice for what was done to their daughter. And her case just really brought home to me. There was an essay in Bobby Wright's Psychopathic Racial Personality that speaks on Black suicide. And it spoke to something you talked about fairly recently, Gus. You talked about the social engineering of Black suicide. And I believe that in the case of Mrs. Bland and quite a few of the other Black females that took their lives in prison, supposedly, that is exactly what was happening to them. They had pressure placed on them that made them feel there was no way out other than to end their lives so they didn't have to deal with the torment of racism and white supremacy. And I think this happens so much more than we are consciously aware of, because the deaths of Black people are taken for granted. So again, my condolences to the Bland family. And also, I wanted to speak on the marijuana breathalyzer test that they're trying to develop. I just thought this was a whole new way of them going about arresting hordes and hordes of Black people. And I could just see that turning into something where they just arrest tons of Black people because they're going to be the ones that are going to be stopped more than anyone else in regards to the whole weed smoking, whenever it becomes legal, because I do see that becoming the case at some point. And this will be used as a means to jail us. And I could see it turning into something like with the FBI finally coming out after all of these hundreds and hundreds of cases in which they fabricated results that ended up convicting people. I could see this being the same case with this marijuana breathalyzer test, a whole slew of false arrests. And then eventually, at some point, after people spent like decades in jail, they'll come out and say, oh, yeah, you know, these were a bunch of mistakes. And then we have a bunch of people get released from prison. The piece that you shared on epigenetics, I just feel like that's already happening. Like, to me, once they put it in the news, it's already something that's going on. And more than likely, it is rich white people that have already had access to it, or I believe are already doing it. And again, I just believe it'll be used to enhance their genetics to try and make them more competitive as far as being genetic recessive mutant beings, to kind of be better competition for the others, which would be non-white people. Also, I thought about Black Lives Matter, and I don't really have a lot of negative things to say about any Black people trying to do something positive, but I just really think the bringing attention to the group sometimes can just take away from the effectiveness of whatever the movement is. And I just thought about when Martin Luther King helped to facilitate the bus boycott. They didn't boycott the bus and then protest in the street. They just basically took other forms of transportation. They shut the system down and basically brought white people to their knees financially by crippling them. So they did the work without broadcasting it or being on the news and sharing placards and chanting slogans. And I just think that there's just more effective ways of affecting white people economically, because that's when they listen. And that's what we saw with the bus boycott. They were able to facilitate crippling the city financially. And at that point, they were able to get white people to somehow, concede to some of the demands that they were making at that particular time. And I think that's something that we really should take advantage of and look at in a more serious way, rather than protesting in a mall. You know, I just feel like it's much less effective, in my opinion. The piece that you played on Seoul, Korea, with the white English-American English teachers, I find that very interesting, because it just goes to show that white supremacist conditioning infects everybody. Non-white people all over the world are infected. And again, the darker you are, the more mistreated you're going to be, no matter where you are in the world, even if you're not surrounded by white people. And it just made me think of a few of the people that I've met, some from Africa, some from the Caribbean and other parts of the world, that I've discussed being indoctrinated with anti-American African sentiment before they get to this country. They're told not to deal with black people in America. A lot of times, some of them talk about being shown videos and news clips of black people committing crimes in this country, and basically associating us or making us the face of crime in America, in a way in which, when even people come from the African continent, they look at us as if we're just criminals, and it's the way that we're perpetuated on the news, and sadly some of us contribute to it through the way that we perform in so-called hip-hop music and a lot of the other popular American art forms that are propagated around the world that make Black people look, Black Americans look like just basically subhuman, animalistic creatures that are meant to be mistreated. And I just feel like the South Korea situation kind of brings that home as far as that white supremacist conditioning that they spread around the world. And then I also recently read an article saying that America has experienced the lowest rate, teen birth rate, between the, for people, young people between the ages of 15 and 19 in, I think, a couple of decades. And I just found that very interesting because they didn't say what the reasoning was. They just made guesses that there was more effective forms of contraception and that less teens may be having sex at this time. And I just don't believe that's necessarily accurate simply because this, we're more hypersexualized now than we've ever been. So I just think, and younger people are exposed to these things a lot, at a lot younger age than ever in the history of this country. So I don't really believe that. And it made me think about something because I started to see a trend of younger people coming out stating that they're so-called homosexual or antisexual. So I was wondering how many of those children are contributing to those factors, because now you have young children being exposed to these antisexual culture in ways that they're now embracing it at younger and younger ages. I'm seeing on the youth, on the news, children as young as six stating that they believe that they're a boy that stated that he believed he was born a female. So I was just wondering how much that contributed to those numbers. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Right on. I just wanted to say for the caller, she was on the VOPE line, the female caller who asked about justice. If I just muted your line because we could hear you typing in the background. That's what I said about the folks. If you get headphones, that would help ease some of that noise. Or you could use your mute button when you dial in if you are talking. Then once you're done talking, just mute your line. But I just muted your line for a second.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to everybody. Peace to the host tonight. I hope your holiday season is going well. I want to give thanks to Thomas in New York for reminding me of something, actually, when he was talking about civil rights leaders and individuals passing away. He said that he kind of had hoped that that mindset left a little bit with them. And I had listened to a brilliant Amos Wilson lecture earlier this week, one that is probably not very well known. I recall the video only had a few thousand views. It was called The Negro Assimilationist. And it is a stunning critique of the desire by the Black leaders of the civil rights movement to actually win appraisals from white people. And the trauma that that legacy had left on the Black community up to the point in time when the lecture was given, it really casts new light on that era of our life. And it's something that I would definitely say people should invest time into listening to. On the clips, the grand jury process, this is stunning that people continue to watch this happen without stating the very, very obvious that grand juries are not necessarily, they're not legal trial mechanisms. They're not meant to be a trial. This is essentially kangaroo courts being set up to try individuals who are guilty in order to prove to the society that they're not guilty. It is what used to go on back in the 50s and the 60s and the 40s. And so it is fundamentally nerve-wracking to me when I constantly hear this. that grand juries come back with not indictments, and that's a form of saying that the person is not guilty. A grand jury isn't meant for that. So I remember some people making that statement early on in the Michael Brown case, but very few have made it since then. This is an illegal process, meaning the system itself is saying we are taking an illegal act and we are piling on new illegal activities. So it's telling you that there is really no justice in white supremacy, but I doubt I have to say that. Something very interesting was going around Facebook this past week, and I really deem it, I think it was a psychological operation. Somebody had posted, a couple of people actually had posted on several pages that I have to follow, this article which stated that the Supreme Court passed a law giving 40 acres and a mule to a slave descendant. And upon just quick fact-checking, I realized, one, the Supreme Court hadn't been in session to pass that, to pass that decision. And two, there wasn't even a law case that was mentioned in the article. And there was no law case that was being presented before the Supreme Court to even suggest that this was a possibility. So, as I tell people constantly on Facebook, do your homework before you react to a story. Respond correctly and do your homework and look up and see if it's indeed true. And finally, about the genetic coding, I cannot tell you how many stories I have read in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, about the business of genetic recoding and encoding. I do indeed believe that it is an attempt to prop up the weaker genetic strains of white people, but beyond that, I'm not 100% sure. I'm not. I do know there's a lot of money in it right now, and a lot of people are pushing billions into it, but I don't really want to speculate to where that's going. And quickly, if I can make a suggestion for a book on the book club, Amos Wilson's Black on Black Violence. And the reason for this is simply one of the retorts that white people continue to push onto black people is, why should we care about police violence against black people when black people do not care about black on black violence? So we know this is a moronic response, but people can be armed with information to diffuse them quickly. All they have to do is read that book. Thank you very much, Gus. Great show tonight. Peace to everybody. Have a great week.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. First subject comes to my mind is a medical one. With the advent of, they are literally thousands of ex-professional football players who are positioning, attempting to try to get some sort of assistance to the advent of concussions. I think primarily the main reason for resistance from the NFL owners is because the vast majority of the victims, as well as the future players, are non-white black males. And it's going to be a big problem to them getting any type of restitution to a brain injury, as far as that concern in reality, in my opinion. I also watched the game between the Carolina Panthers and New York Giants, and most times I have the sound turned down when I'm watching a game, because I don't need anybody to be commenting and whatnot. I can watch the game myself and see what's going on. And but I had it up, and I can see the announcers focusing on two black males. I think one of them last name or first name is Norman, and the other one is was the receiver for the New York Giants. And basically, they was making, in my opinion, a big deal about violence. One thing about football itself is violence always around, and there's definitely violence always into the NFL in play all the time. The difference is you have many more cameras that can pick it up if one wants to pick it up and observe it and therefore comment on it. And so I'm just looking to stay tuned on how that materializes as far as quote-unquote black males and violence when it comes to professional sports. On how that's going to expand as far as the talk more and more about it. Because as we know, the vast majority of the players in the National Football League are black males. Had an interesting event that I attended at a college, local college down here in South Florida, Miami to be exact, Barry University, where they had a fundraising rally for an organization called, the first part of the name is Dream Something. I'm not sure what the other part of the name is, Dream Believers, something like that. It's supposed to be a group similar to Black Lives Matter. And they were had a fundraising rally, and the keynote speaker was Dr. Angela Davis, as she is known today as Dr. Angela Davis, as far as what was on the brochure. And what was interesting, she spoke for about 20 minutes. She spoke for about 20 minutes, and then they had this sit-down panel, and I noticed through the speech that it was well, actually, before I even went to the event, I was told about the event. I asked the person who told about the event on what would be the subject matter, because I'm always concerned about that, on what the subject matter. When they mentioned about the school to prison pipeline and some other things concerning non-white people and the gray confinement, then I said, okay, well, I'll go and check it out. But primarily what I observed through the entire event was there was a lot of mixture of quote unquote gay rights, and it gave me a caution light. Although I respect and admire Miss Davis and her courage that she had during her years as someone who is recognized as attempting to practice counter racism. There were some things about the speech that was mixed in about gay rights and things of that nature during the speech, to whereas it kind of like was rivaling with countering the system of racism, white supremacy. And beyond Ms. Davis or any individual non-white black person who I don't want to directly criticize, I would say that this seems to be encouraged and also financed by white people who are very shrewd and powerful, to confuse the subject matter by mixing in sexual confusion into the equation, I think is becoming more and more popular to do so. That's one thing that I noticed. I also noticed that most of the people that was on the panel, although most of the workers were very heavily melanated non-white people, the people who were quote-unquote out in front were either non-white, non-black people, or non-white people who are very less melanated. And those are just some of the things that I noticed at the rally, and how the countering message to white supremacy was kind of like wasn't very clear. I put it that way. Wasn't very clear at all. So it's something to be observed that is becoming, I think, quite popular now. And that's all I have to report. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. On to sort of piggybacking on what some callers have said about Black Lives Matters, or Black Lives Matter, one of the things that I noticed, I actually went on their About page recently, and this is one of the things that always bothers me about protesting. I think in a Canadian context, because we have Black Lives Matter Toronto, I think it's important for us because, as I've said before, Canada often likes to silence its racism issues. So I think in that sense, it's important. But beyond the awareness level, I think it gets a bit problematic because it's sort of like what that last caller was saying about how, you know, gay rights or even some cases women's rights always overtakes just a focus on takes away from the focus on dealing with racism, white supremacy. One of the things I noticed about the Black Lives Matters page is that, Black Lives Matter page is that when they're in their About page, like that tells you, I guess it's sort of like a mission statement. They critique Black nationalism and anything about buying Black or love Black. They criticize it as being, you know, queerphobic or homophobic, anti-woman, and just benefiting straight Black males. Of course, not giving any substantive analysis of Black nationalism. And in it, which is probably most relevant, there is no critique of white supremacy as the fundamental problem that Black people have to deal with. Not at all. It doesn't come up ever as the problem. That I find very disturbing. And I think it's also tied to what some callers have already addressed. This silly idea, and I call it a silly idea, that somehow integration should be equated with Black liberation. I think at some point we're going to have to realize that integration fails. And there's always folks, even from slavery, even the debates that activists and scholars then have had during the civil rights movement, where you had Black power and civil rights movement, there's always been critiques. And I find it disturbing that the only aspects of the 50s and 60s that people want to imitate or follow is the ones that, quite frankly, are comforting to whites, like nonviolence and all these intersectionality stuff, but never what actual Black power folks actually said. There's never an interest in actually learning about that, and I find that very disturbing. And that's all I have for now.
Yes, ma'am. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Hello, is that better?
That is an improvement.
Hi, this is Lady. I wanted to make a brief comment before workplace racism regarding the infant mortality rate here in America and just how it's affecting African-American women and children. We had a big production here where I live, and PBS came out, and they actually made some type of documentary about it. And at the end of the documentary, it was very interesting because white racism and these white supremacists really kind of lay out at the end that they are the result, or they are the cause of the problem. So I pulled up an article from that documentary, and they actually have a name for this, calling it toxic stress. And on the documentary and in this article, it's stating that they have researched it. They have concluded that the result is consistent and relentless stress, including threats to their survival and daily concerns about subsistence, and also resulting from institutional racism and disproportionate unequal opportunities to these mothers is why the infants are dying before their first year. They know that in healthcare, during their prenatal exams, they're not going to get the proper care. That's probably why they're not going. There's going to be barriers to getting there. They know there's all kind of issues that are going to start from the moment that the mom finds out that she's pregnant, and that they are the cause. Their racism, their system, their stress is what is leading to the death of these infants. And I think it's on purpose. It's majority African-American infants that are dying. That's the highest percentage. And I really feel that it is a part of racial population tailoring. So that I just wanted to mention that because that was something that was a very big thing that happened where I'm living in my town, because we are we're even higher compared to other places when it comes to this infant mortality before the age of one. So that's all I want to say. I'll mute my line until workplace racism.
On that note, we have about 3 minutes until we get to workplace racism. Is anybody that we have not heard from, if you didn't get a chance to share at all and you have something you want to get in before workplace racism, be quick.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Greetings, callers, Gus, listeners. This is a female caller from New York. I just want to chime in very, very briefly regarding Dr. Bennett and his movie Concussion. I don't know if anybody's seen the cover of Sports Illustrated, or we talked about that. Will Smith is on the cover, and the title reads as follows: Concussion. Will Smith shines a light on football's darkest corner and the future of America's game. And Dr. Welding always talk about symbolism. The cover is dark itself. Will Smith is in a grayish sort of suit with a black tie and a black shirt with white polka dots. He is leaning over a black table, which is reflective, and it's reflecting back at him. So I think there's a whole lot of symbolism in this. And also, I don't believe it was him that shined a light on this issue. I think it was Dr. Bennett. But since he has such a sour relationship with the NFL, and I think they want to pretty much downplay that. And on the other hand, as I see it, they got to have somebody to go after. So who better than to try to go after, if they're going to come after anybody, they have to come after a black person. They're surely not going to come after the producer. He's not on the cover. It's Will Smith that's on the cover. So I thought that was really interesting. And that's all I, and the author is of the article, his name is Ben Reiter. R-E-I-T-E-R. I'm guessing, I could be incorrect, that that is a racist suspect, but I will read the article later on at my leisure. That's all I have to say. I'll mute my line.
For sure. We have about 60 seconds if we missed anybody. I just wanted to say, really, you'll still get your whole 60. Just the name of the male that I mentioned before, where his family spoke out and said that they falsified this part of Concussion, Dave Durson. I hope I'm saying his last name correctly, D-U-E-R-S-O-N. He played for the Bears and some other teams, what have you. He was supposedly a really great player. But he's passed away now. He took his own life and suffered from CTE. That they are talking about in the film, but his family spoke out and said that they falsified the part where he's brawling with another black male in the film and calling him a sellout and all that, that didn't happen, and they don't even know why they had to falsify that in the film. And even related to the clip that I played about infant mortality rates and maternal mortality rates. That's in Concussion as well, where Will Smith's wife, she's pregnant with their first child. And I mean, these are gangsters. Like, the NFL is a, you know, multi-billion dollar global conglomerate of white folks, probably lots and lots of well-paid race soldiers. And, you know, like, please, this, you think we're going to let some nigger scientist mess up our business? So in the film, they portray where they send some goons out to follow her and stress, exactly as the female caller just brought up. She's stressed and she ends up having a miscarriage. But that's right in Concussion. The white gangsterism on display. Do we have some, anybody that did not get a chance to share? Did you want 60 seconds to get your comment before we get to workplace racism? Oh, if we got everybody, that is Grant. We'll just go right to workplace racism. Did we miss anybody? Sure we didn't, because I think I got everybody who had a hand up. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who didn't get a chance to share?
I hate Beckys.
Okay. Right on.
That goes right into workplace racism.
Right on. We will go ahead and get our transition on. White women are dangerous. We will get our transition to workplace racism. Folks want to participate. The number again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Princess still hates Beckys. Workplace racism. Folks have things they want to share. Everybody's line should be open. I'll look, you know, for new folks that are dialing in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. This is Princess. I'll try and be brief and start off with what transpired today. Basically, I requested to be sent home because I felt like I was going to rip this Becky's head off, because all morning she was harassing me and antagonizing me because I was just keeping to myself. And so finally she did something and I was just like, you know what? Today's not the day. I've been quiet for the past month since another incident happened where the assistant store manager had made, I guess you would say, a racially insensitive comment. And, well, this happened a couple of weeks ago because I had went on my trip to Florida because my mom is sick. And so I'm in the process of moving back home and just really been tired, but I had already drawn up my documentation as to what I was going to send to corporate about what was said, and but have been trying to convince myself to just not worry about doing it, but now I have to because Becky's are out of control. So but basically, you know, she tried to come at me and say, you know, after I went to the office, grabbed a sheet of paper, wrote down the time and what and whatever notes as to what had taken place. She saw me in another department and all of a sudden sound concerned as to what was going on with Princess. And I calmly told her that I'm not in the mood to talk to her right now, and that it would be best for her to leave me alone or to go ahead and send me home, because literally I was seeing red and I was going to rip her fucking head off. And so she was just basically trying to convince me to go to the office along with the same individual. And I said, no, actually, either you want to talk to me here, and I was cool, calm, and cordial, or you can send me home, because I'm not going into the office so you guys can play games, and, you know, I'm done. I've been, every time, it seems like whenever I particularly open, you know, she wants to send me on these menial tasks and just throw me around all over the place, and I'm not going to do all that. So she excuses herself to go to the office. I think she either went and met with her assistant store manager, talking about what they were going to do, or either called the district manager. Really didn't give a fuck at that point. So she comes back and basically, as if she's trying to tell me something, that says, well, Princess, as your store manager, either you can come into the office or you can be sent home. I'm looking at her like, well, that's what I've been asking you. If I stay here, I'm going to cut your ass out and do something, and then I'm going to be in trouble and then get fired. So that's for you to send me home now. So once I told her, you know, to go ahead and send me home, you know, she obliged. And I just immediately clocked out and left home. I had also just the other night found out that the reason why she has this issue in particular with majority of the black women there is because this Becky is in a relationship with a black male. And so it seems like she's all buttered up whenever it's black males that she's interacting with in the office. But towards the black females, you know, she doesn't mind showing or flexing her muscles when it comes to disciplinary action. So
G-rated, please.
I'm sorry. It just put everything together. And so, yeah, that's pretty much what I've been dealing with. It's some other stuff, but I'll mute my line and let everybody else talk.
Man, I am sorry to hear that. Man, I have said consistently, I think we try to touch on the white women are terrorists in the workplace in terms of how they function. I have said also, I think it's important to recognize when you get to that point of frustration about how things are going, it's really good to be aware of where you are, what your feelings are, when you have kind of reached your threshold where you don't have the patience to deal anymore. Just say, this is not the time for me to have conversation, dialogue, whatever the case may be. I just need to exit if that means that I need to clock out for the day, and we can try this again tomorrow, what have you. I think that that's good as well, because you just don't want to get in a situation where you already know that you're upset and you have reached your limit, and then to go in when you don't have patience, when you're not codified, when you're not going to be able to keep your cool and go in and, you know, blow up and say something or do something or what have you. That's just going to make the situation way worse. So I definitely think that that is important to do at all times. Do you have any idea how this is going to unfold on Monday? Like, are you getting your plan together for what you plan to do on Monday?
Well, she had indicated when she had came back the second time, and after I refused to go into the office in their little tag team meeting, that I needed to give a written statement as to why or what the situation was. I mean, she's going to play dumb because that's what Becky's do. And so I was just like, okay, cool. I already had my district manager's number. So before I pulled off, I had already called him and told him that he'll be receiving whatever I give to corporate, because the way they have set up now, since this new management came to this location, that all employee complaints or any type of HR issues are forwarded directly to him. So he'll get a copy of whatever I send, but I just want something in writing. I don't want to do anything over the phone, because I know when I first had my issue at my first location, things were being taken out of context and in some cases just completely flipped around. So I want to provide something, you know, strictly in writing, spelling out to the letter what I'm talking about. So there's no distortion of where I'm coming from. And I had already spoken to my other former assistant store manager, and she was pretty much saying that now would be the time for me to definitely emphasize that I want to be transferred at this point, or relocated back to Florida, because he's already in the process of moving several people, including her. So she was just giving me some pointers and things to look out for that's going on in the district already.
might be good if you're gonna, and if other people have suggestions, that's great too. If you have anything you want to share with Princess, I was just gonna say it might be good as you're writing your statement to check the policy and procedure manual to see if the suspected racist, if she has violated any specific policies, what have you. I think it's always good if you can use their language to write down where they have violated their own policy and how they have dealt with you and how that's contributing to the problems that you're experiencing on the job. That would just be a recommendation, and definitely the right. That's why I say all the time about documentation. That way, when these type of things happen and it comes time where there is an incident and you have to write something up or have some sort of conference or what having documentation so you can look back at your notes. You just don't want to trust your memory. That's one of the main things. You just don't want to leave all that to, I can remember everything that's happened in my tenure with this particular company. When you have documentation about all the incidents that you've had with this specific white person, what's been the problem and all that, it makes it so much easier where you can go down and you can be detailed, date, time, boom, this is what they said, this is what they did, boom, 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 and then you match that up with policy. I think it puts you in a much, much stronger position in dealing with whites on the job, but that's just my suggestion. Did other folks listening in, do y'all have any suggestions you want to give out to Princess?
I just really hate working with them. It's like it never fails.
That is white people to be expected. Even when it looks like it's going well, you can expect that on the horizon. That unfortunately is the problem that we're dealing with. If Princess had anything else she wanted to share, or if other folks had their own workplace racism experience they wanted to get in, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, I had a workplace racist incident probably around about 4 months ago. You know, I hurt my hand at work, and I went to the doctor. They sent me to a work comp doctor, and, you know, the doctor, you know, saw me, did x-ray and everything, saw my hand wouldn't work. Hit me in the spring or some type of thing I had to put around my wrist, and told me to come see him a week later. And, you know, I did it. And so a week later, you know, still was in pain and could not move my hand, really. Could not really move my left hand. Couldn't bend it or anything, you know. And, well, he was like, well, and like you said, like you just said, a lot, trying to trust everything on exact memory is kind of hard when it's not documented. But I probably can't say verbatim what he said, but I can kind of say, you know, a little bit what he said. But he was like, well, it just looked like a bad sprain. And, you know, just come back in next week, and we gonna try to see if we gonna get you back to work. And I'm telling them, like, well, you did an x-ray and there wasn't any bone damage, but do you think I can get something like a CAT scan or anything like that where I could try to see if it was any tissue damage or something? I don't know much about medicine, but I, you know, be around folks that work in hospitals, and, you know, they were talking about these different things. So I asked him about, could he check to see did I have any tissue damage? And he got upset, you know, don't you be reading all this stuff here on the internet, think you're going to be coming here and telling me how to do my job and things like that, you know what I'm saying? He said, just come see me next week, and we're going to try to see if we can get you back to work. And, you know, so I'm like, okay. He's gonna give me a problem. You see what I'm saying? Because he's not really interested in treating my hand. It seemed like he's just interested in returning me back to work. So I said, our next conversation, I'll record. So, you know, waited a week, you know, like I said, he came back in, same thing, couldn't move my hand. So it's 3 weeks Can't even move my hands. So this got to be some bad, this got to be some bad spring. Like, you know, my hand is just immobile for 3 weeks, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, I come in, he take the thing off, the little scrapbook thing, whatever, wrist, I forgot what he called it, what you call it. But he took that off my hand, and it split, something like a split, but he took that off my hand. And he moved it up, he moved it down, you know, slowly. And, you know, he said, well, seemed like it better. And I said, well, yeah, I could always move my hand with the assistance of my other hand. But if I tried to move my hand by itself, it won't move. And he was like, why can't you move your hand? You know? And he got, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. Like I said, I had recorded on video. But he got rude with me. And he grabbed my hand and mashed it back. You see what I'm saying? Real hard. Knowing that it was in pain. And I said, well, you know, I was adamant about it, and I got upset, and I was like, man, you about to rip my hand. You see what I'm saying? You about to dab in my hand even more. You see what I'm saying? And so he was like, I don't like how you have to. Get out of here. You see what I'm saying? And so I'm leaving out of there. And I'm thinking the whole time, well, I'm leaving out, but I still need medical assistance. My hand hasn't been able to move for 3 weeks. So I'm like, okay, man, this suspected racist, you know, is giving me problems, is basically refusing to give me medical treatment. But let me try to start over and see if, you know, I can get medical treatment. And I'm coming up to him. Like I said, I was recorded. I said, look, man, before I can even say anything to try to get us on another footing, he said, I don't want to talk to you, man. He said, get out of here. And I told him, I said, you asked me to diagnose my own problem. I'm just telling you, I'm not a doctor. I cannot diagnose my own problem. I can't tell you why my hand can't move. I can only tell you that I hurt my hand at work and it cannot move. Man, do you want to go to jail? Do you want to go to jail? Get the F out. I ain't going to say because he's G-rated. But get the F out of my office. And I said, wow, man, why you talking to me like that, man? I said, I'm just trying to tell you, man, I can't move my hand. I don't know why I can't move my hand. And I said, what else? I said, one more thing. I said, yeah. I said, are you refusing to give me medical treatment? He said, yes, I'm refusing to give you medical treatment. And then, they're grabbing me. The nurses grabbing me. You know, grabbing me. I don't know why they're grabbing me. He's the one that's being vulgar, threatening to put me in jail just for seeking medical treatment. He basically physically assaulted me when he ripped my hand, mushed my hand back, and he cursed me out. But the whole time, I didn't get loud or anything. But they grabbing me. You see what I'm saying? He's the one that's being violent. You see what I'm saying? So I told him, I said, man, get your hand off me. I told him, don't touch me. And I said, you refuse to give me medical treatment. I'm leaving the building. They sent me up to Birmingham, you know. This was the work comp just to do. They sent me up to Birmingham. The Birmingham folks did an x-ray, and then they did an ultrasound. They found out I had some type of damage to my ligaments, you know, but it wasn't torn or anything. It was just swollen, you know, and, you know, they gave me some, they put me on steroids, gave me treatment of steroid pills, and, you know, that didn't work, you know, but I could make a long story out of that, you know, but I'm going to just stick with the doctor part because the racism goes on, but I know other people got things too. But, yeah, man, I can put that on your page, man, if you want me to. Y'all can witness the whole thing. How they treat black folks in hospitals is disgusting. It's just as bad as police brutality. Now, mute my mind.
Wow. If you're talking about the video, absolutely. If you, you know, want to share and any additional commentary, that's something we can make it a guest post. I can put it on my blog as well. We could, like, attach the video and then anything that you want to write. you know, just to add so people have more information about what you experienced. But I mean,
the entire process.
I'm sorry?
I said, well, I could tell you the entire process, the racism, where it goes from not just from that doctor, from the people I worked with, the work comp adjuster, the doctor they sent me to, the doctor they sent me to in Birmingham, all this. They even had to pay me out, but they didn't even pay me everything. You know, only part I did get a settlement from was the work comp adjuster. But the part about the doctors and them, you know, the folks fired me. You know, and I'm going to make this real quick. The folks fired me. Basically, the folks railroaded me back to work. They told me, they said, hey, you going back to work. I said, well, I still can't move my hand. Now I have a job where I'm dragging 6,000-pound pallets across the parking lot into Rite Aid. I'm loading up. I'm doing stocking all over the Rite Aid, all over the Southeast. So, you know, how am I going to be able to do that with one hand? In the other hand, they have to move at that time probably about 2 months. I said, well, you know, hopefully the medicine worked, but we don't know if it's going to work. But she said, well, you're going to go back to work. You know, well, that's all I'm telling you, you know. And so they were like, all right, they rushed me out of the building. Called in, told them, well, the guy said, well, ain't nothing we can do. They said, you got to go back to work. I said, okay, well, I'll call back in next week, get my schedule, right? Well, I'm fine. I don't have any choice. What can I do? You know, I have to report to work. If I don't report to work, they'll be failure to report to work, and I'm fired. So I call in, get my schedule. He say, well, you're fired. I said, I'm fired. I said, I'm fired for what? He said, well, you're fired because you hurt yourself. And I said, well, that's why they got work comp and everything like that. I did everything by protocol, and I'm returning back to work. He said, well, you did something that was not safe. The way you hurt your hand, knitting out a landing gear. I said, could you tell me what I did that wasn't safe? No, I can't tell you what you did wasn't safe. I said, okay, that's fine. Well, could you tell me someone who witnessed me do something that wasn't safe? No, there's nobody to witness you do anything that wasn't safe. So why are you saying I was doing something that wasn't safe? Just bring uniform in. And you know what? He stick to that story. Even my lawyer said, by on the record, in the Alabama courts, it's on record that is his response to me for firing me. I did something that was not safe. I can't tell you what you did that wasn't safe. Okay, who witnessed me do something that wasn't safe? No one witnessed it. You know, but I mute my line, and yes, sir, thank you. I will post that, too. Thanks, guys.
For sure, for sure. Sorry to hear all of the pain to be physically injured, and then on top of that to be terminated from the job and told it's your fault. I mean, but that goes back to the whole premise of, you know, what this program is about and what we mean when we say racism, white supremacy. That, you know, this is what you can expect. White people are not ignorant. This is standard operating procedure. And even I think one of the first people that called in, we said, well, can we get justice within this system? It's simply not designed to produce justice. It's designed to produce exactly what we just heard. These type of incidents over and over and over. And I can again say, you do not get out of this just because you are quote unquote self-employed. It just will be manifested in a different way under the system of white supremacy. But I mean, with those type of situations, I think a lot of different states, they have what they call right to work. So they just make up any excuse that they want to fire black people. Well, I will say, with any situation where you're injured on the job, if you're in that sort of situation where you go to someone who is hired by the company, a physician or a medical practitioner, they're hired by the company. They are obviously not going to be working in your interest. 10 times out of 9, they're not going to be working in your interest. They're going to be in the company's interest. Let's get them back on the job as quickly as possible. This is not serious. We don't need to compensate him. This person, he or she is ready to work. Go back, you know, right now, in the next 5 minutes. Particularly in the type of thing that you mentioned where they're being hostile, unprofessional, just downright terroristic in the way that they're dealing with you. I would, you know, recommend trying to see if you can seek a different physician. I think Daryl Washington with Recology in San Francisco, he got injured on the job, and it wasn't, at least from my recollection, it wasn't as bad as what you just mentioned in terms of the hostility from the doctor, but the practitioner that the company Recology told him to go see was not as helpful as he could have been, and he ended up getting a different medical opinion, and that ended up being more advantageous to Mr. Washington with his situation, getting a second physician to look at his injury. I forgot what body part he injured, but being able to go and get a second medical opinion when he felt like they were not being helpful to him, the doctors that he was supposed to go see that were being paid for by the company. And of course, the company, you know, wrangled about that, but that's definitely something that I would recommend for folks. Certainly once it gets to the point where they're being hostile and everything, but even if they're being courteous, nice, they're not cursing at you and hurting you or aggravating your injury. But if you just don't think that you're getting proper care and treatment, see if you can get a second medical opinion, a different doctor, maybe even someone that's not funded by the company, and check the policy and procedure on that as well, to see if you can get a second medical opinion. Did anybody have any?
Yes, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, they ended up, after they fired me, they ended up seeing me two more times, and they gave me some steroids, some more steroids, but it wasn't the pill. They put me on shots, and the shots ended up working, and my hand back moving and everything. Now, I'm all the way well now. But the question I had to ask, do you think, now I asked a lawyer, about it, but he was a Caucasian lawyer. I tried to seek advice from two black lawyers. They seemed like they didn't want nothing to do with it. But my question is, do you think it would be anything that I could go after that doctor for threatening to put me in jail and cursing me out and refusing me medical treatment when I still was injured?
You have video footage on that one. That might be something that you might be worth the time and energy to see if you could speak with an attorney, show them the video footage that you have and explain your situation to see what they think. That might be something where you can make some ground.
I looked into it. I looked into it, and honestly, man, they telling me now there's nothing you can do about it. Mm. You know, but I'm like, man, come on. There's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm injured. I could see if I went to Birmingham and they saw nothing was wrong with my hand when they gave me the ultrasound. You see, then, okay, yeah, there's nothing I can do about it. But this man refusing to check and see if I have tissue damage, cursed me out, threatened to put me in jail, and you telling me there's nothing I can do about it? I don't think that would be the same thing if I was a Caucasian male that hurt himself on the job. You would tell me there's nothing I can do about it. If there's a black doctor that cursed me out and did all that. You know, it's just the ridiculousness of it. And then I know I'm not going to be anti-black, but I'm going to just say that it's amazing how we have people that are powerful and have the education and the know-how, and they talk all this help about helping the grassroots people. But when grassroots people come to them, they don't care until a camera around. I'm sorry for being anti-black, but that's just being reality, man. You know, I apologize. I'm using my lines there. And you real dude, man. And you know you do a lot for the people, man. And I thank you for your show, man. I'm mute my lines, and I continue to listen and learn.
Oh, for sure. If folks have any suggestions, feel free. I just wanted to get in about the doctor aspect because we had talked about that earlier this year. And it was a black physician on the program, and she was saying, going through her training in med school, that it was a lot of racist material and talking about black females having children that are going to be more criminal and just all the standard stuff that you can expect. And saying that going through medical school, you end up having to accept a lot of that racist ideology to get that piece of paper so that you can go ahead and be a doctor or whatever you're going to do in the healthcare industry. So that to me is not surprising at all. And I'm sure that applies across the board, not just in the healthcare industry, but throughout all of the different professions in the system of white supremacy. Was that Karma? Were you going to make a suggestion?
Yes. I was going to let the caller know that, you know, despite the fact that the doctor is a victim, his mistreatment is not your problem. You know, you're injured. So I would probably go to the state and just pull up his name and pull up his insurance carrier. And if you're anywhere near a university, just have the law school, one of the law school students write you up a letter. You can get them to do that. Go ahead and submit that to the state and his insurance company, because you're probably not the first patient he's mistreated, and he's probably a serial mistreater. So no, they're telling you there's nothing there. There is something there. There is something there.
He's notorious for that. He lost his job because of some criminal activity. He's notorious in this city. Yes, ma'am, you're correct. And I probably won't remember what you said right now, but I will listen to the recording of this show, and I will follow your steps about going up to the school, too.
Bobby Hurd?
Yes, ma'am.
I just also wanted to suggest I've been through something similar here in New York, and we have a New York State Department of Education. And I totally concur with what Carmen just said. Everything that she said ran through my mind with regard to doing your own investigation on this doctor, because I know that this is not the first time he's done this. So if your state has a Department of Education, file a complaint. There's usually able to do one online. So that would be another avenue you can take. And also what Karma said, but do your own investigation, and it's worth pursuing, especially if you have video. That's all I had. I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, we can hear you. I don't know if you muted or got disconnected.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Sorry. I'm trying to figure out how to use this phone. For the caller that had the issue with the physician, most practices have administrators or paid personnel, and their job is to investigate complaints for patients. And there's usually some type of, action at least to address the dissatisfaction of the patient. So he should be able to follow up with an administrator in the hospital or the clinic, wherever he was seen. I had two items to share regarding workplace racism that happened this week. I work in an office, and I'm a healthcare provider, and I was working with one of my medical assistants, and both of us are Black, and one of the radiology techs had come out, and she was saying she had some watermelon left over from her lunch that she wasn't going to eat, and she wanted to know if we wanted some of the watermelon, and both of us, you know, declined, and then, you know, she went back to doing whatever she was doing, and then I guess maybe like 30 minutes or an hour or so later, she came back and she's like, are you sure that you don't want any watermelon? I mean, it's warm, but are you sure that you don't want it? And again, we both were like, no, thanks, you know, we're fine. So that was...
Your volume dropped. Your volume dropped. We heard up to the second...
What was the last part that you...
Okay, the second offer of watermelon. Are you sure you don't want any watermelon? And then it kind of trailed off. But we can hear you now if you want to pick up from there.
Yeah, she said, are you sure you don't want any? You know, it's warm because it hasn't been in the refrigerator, but, you know, I'm just going to throw it away. And again, we both declined. And then the second instance, I was talking with a coworker, and we're just going through charts. Our workstation, and we were talking about actors, and she got on the subject of Angelina Jolie, and she was like, oh, you know, I don't like her. She has DSL. And I didn't know what she meant when she said DSL, so I asked, I said, well,
what does DSL mean? And she was like, I know this is a G-rated show, so I'll just spell it. It was D-I-C-K, sucking lip. And I just thought that was really, I don't know. I just was taken aback because I had never heard that term before. And she was referencing Angelina Jolie. But I'm thinking, well, if that's what they say about her and she's a white woman, like, what do they say about black women's lips or fuller people who have fuller lips? It was just an odd thing. And that was all I had to share.
Right on. First time caller. Good to hear from you. Two incidents. Oddly enough, I have heard DSL before. it's been a while, but I have heard that one. I don't know if that's an East Coast slang thing or what, or even if people still say it, I don't hear it as frequently. Maybe it's not used as frequently now, but that is one I'm familiar with. And the watermelon thing. That's what I say on the job. Like, just, I wouldn't care what it is. We're declining everything, and you just wait for the racist punchline to be there, even if, you know, this is the friendliest white person ever and coming up. I would just automatically assume her coming up and she's got to insist on trying to shove watermelon on you that, you know, I already know what this is. No thanks, I'm cool. Let's just go about our business. We have other folks who had workplace racism that they wanted to share. We're kind of winding down with the program. Anybody?
Can I?
Let's see.
Go ahead, you go first.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'll try to make it quick. I was recently, a few months ago, I was actually recently fired from my job. White women are extremely dangerous. I worked at a world-renowned medical facility in New York City. I was hired as a supervisor. The white woman was my manager. I have a pretty good work ethic where I come into work early. And if there are any issues during the interview, the white woman had told me that, oh, well, you know, you pretty much are going to have to be a babysitter to these women. And where I worked, I was a supervisor for patient access. So I would say I was supervising in that facility about 25 women, and about 97% of the women were Latina, and three of them or four of them were black female. So that was the first thing during the interview. But when I finally got to the job, the director of the department, whom the manager had to report to, was a black woman. And she had, I guess, warned me prior to actually starting the job. She told me, in her own words, she told me that the woman was, we're not using profanity. So she told me, she called her a female dog. And so the woman was supposed to be training me, the manager,
no.
The manager was supposed to be training me.
Sorry about that.
Sorry.
Just somebody's background noise. Go ahead, ma'am. Sorry about that.
The manager was supposed to be training me, as was directed by her boss, and she did everything that she could not to train me. Or when I would go into her office, okay, are you ready for me? Are you ready to see me? Are you ready? Oh, well, I'm busy. I don't have the time. So that was something that happened to me often. So the director, who was a black woman, she had to actually have me sitting with other supervisors and train with them because my manager didn't want to train me. And there was another supervisor that worked in our department, but she happened to be a Latina female. Some of the things that I had heard that were told to me by the director of the department was that this white woman had been transferred from various departments. And so it goes back to what you've said on many occasions, that white people don't get fired, they get transferred. And the director of the department, her boss, who was a boss of everyone, he had a Spanish name, but I don't think he was Latino. I don't think you could identify him as Latino. I think he was identified as Caucasian. He told the director of the department that he could not fire her because it was against his religion, and that's a direct quote. I don't know what that meant, but that was a direct quote that she told me from him. Additionally, it had been told to me as well that there was a union meeting. There was a meeting between the manager, the white woman, the director of the department, of course, had to be there, and one of the staff members who happened to be a very, very dark-skinned Latina female, black Latina, I don't know what happened, but it just had been mentioned to me that she actually was a union representative, and there had to be a union delegate as well at this particular meeting. And during the meeting, the union delegate asked the white woman, "Do you like black people?" And he proclaimed that I believe that you are a racist. And so this woman, in addition to all of the stuff that I'm telling you, she adopted two non-white, non-black Mexican children. And she had made the comment at a general meeting for management that, "Oh, well, you know, I've adopted two Mexican kids. Now I have my own landscapers." So when I did lose my job, there was no real recourse that I can take because it was a 6-month probation and I had actually lost my job halfway through. So she called herself giving me a pre-probation review. And she told me straight up that she wouldn't hire me. She said, "It's not that I don't work, because I do work. It's just that I was very intimidating to the staff." And so when they did call me into the office to give me my walking papers, they did not give me a specific reason why I was fired. All the white woman said was, "You know, when we had the mid-probation review, I haven't seen any changes." But of course she hadn't seen any changes because I hadn't been sitting there with her. She hadn't been training me. I was actually at different sites training with different supervisors. So if there were any changes made, of course she wouldn't see it because I hadn't spent any time in that office in over a month or maybe a few weeks after she gave me that pre-probation review. So luckily, I'm at a new job now, and I work with an office full of black people. It's not too many people in the office. However, there is one white person in the office, but the people in the prominent roles are black people. So I'm just keeping my fingers crossed, hoping that this goes a lot better than the other job. It's also in the medical field, but it's a smaller facility. So I've been wanting to tell the story for a while, but I had to take a little bit of time because I was a bit traumatized from it because I've never experienced losing my job, and I've never experienced losing a job in this way because I thought I was doing everything correct, coming in early, doing what I was told, and that still wasn't good enough. So as much as I thought that I knew about how racism, white supremacy works, there's always still a lot to learn. And as Mr. Fuller would say, still learning. So thank you for listening.
Ashe, thank you. Thank you for sharing that training thing. I know Mr. Edward Williams, we have done whole programs talking about that. That is hugely important, where white people deliberately do not train black people, non-white people on the jobs, don't give adequate training. They kind of do just a real, mediocre job with the training, so you don't get all the details, so that you can be totally proficient, so that they have an easy excuse to fire. And I know, Mr. Williams, we've done whole programs where he talks about you want to get that in writing. If there's any obstacles, if they're acting like they don't want to do it, or I don't have time to train you, or I can't do it, and that sort of thing, get that documented, that, you know, there's obstruction to you being trained, because you can bring that up. And he's got that in his book and talked about it on the program, how you can use that if they're, you know, coming at you and saying that they're going to do something to you, you're not going to get a promotion, or you're going to get fired, or whatever the case may be, because you're not doing your job adequately, when it's, wait a minute, I haven't been trained to do my job adequately. You are essentially, you are setting me up for failure, to be terminated or whatever else they want. We're going to deny you promotions and that sort of thing. I will see if we can get in one more workplace, because we're already over the 3-hour limit, but workplace racism is important. We'll see if we can get in one more. I guess I will make some adjustments, and I'll make a note, just with this being the quote unquote holiday season. And some people did say that these were incidents that had happened previously, and they, you know, wanted to share now. That's important too, the stress that you might not even be able to talk about it immediately. You might need some time to be able to share publicly. But I would not be surprised at all if white people intensify their terroristic attacks on the job at this time of year, because they say, oh, we know we're going to do all of our conditioning to have them going out and spending all this money and all this other stuff, so we'll wait to put the whammo on them right at the end of the year, so we'll have them totally stressed out and going crazy. What am I going to do? I can't buy this, can't get this for my children, that sort of thing. It would not surprise me at all if they sit around on their coffee breaks, lunch hour, burning the midnight oil to say, yes, we'll turn up the terrorism on them an extra notch or so at this time of year. I thought there was one other. Was there another female caller? I know I heard Ross as well. Was there another female who was going to share with work? Yes, ma'am. Just make sure you speak up.
Oh, this is Lady again. I just wanted to give an update about the incident on the job where the coworker hit me. I had put in 3 complaints, and one I heard back from, which was very typical of a racist suspect. The gentleman who was reviewing my complaint, pretty much when I called to ask for a status of the complaint, started immediately scolding me once he found my paperwork, yelling at me, saying that this is not something he does, I need to go seek other means, and why haven't I gone to seek other means. Even though prior to speaking to him, his staff and throughout New York State, you know, I called a main number and told me that this is definitely something that would go to his department, immediately was scolding me, and to where I had to cut the conversation short. And I said, well, then I'd like something in writing stating that you don't handle this type of incident, and that this is not who I would report this to, and why, because he was so aggressive in his tone. I did wind up leaving that employment situation, not because of that incident, but due to quite a few other just issues with collaborating with other victims, to get to work, pretty much. So I had to leave because of that. Well, due to family responsibilities, pretty much. I had to leave due to those things. And so I'm just waiting to hear back, because he still has not sent that out regarding why he would not handle this situation, and then who it should be sent to, or who I should be putting a complaint into. So just update you guys as I hear. But it's just looking like, you know, that nothing's going to happen to her for hitting me on the job. Maybe I did something wrong according to them, I guess. I don't know. But I'll keep everyone updated.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Way over. Is it any way you can?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is there any way you can condense your incident? Because we're already over time. Can you condense it? Sorry about that, Roz.
Yeah, it's actually very short. This past Thursday at work, they had a potluck. I don't do potlucks. So essentially, I took some food and dumped it in the garbage. I don't eat from people on the job, and I'm surrounded by white terrorists, so I don't do that. That's it. Thank you.
Right on. I think we did miss, we didn't get everybody in, but I was not prepared for such a number of different incidents of workplace racism. I know the holiday thing, people having food incidences, Roz just shared, but I will make adjustments as we roll. If, you know, we have more folks that want to share, people that didn't get to share workplace racism this week, certainly next week. And we can even maybe look at moving that up a little bit. We can adjust how we use our time for the compensatory call-in, because the workplace stuff is very important. I'd even be cool with spending more time on workplace racism just to get that done, because that's super important. At any rate, we will be back. We should have... one, we're doing our end of the year program on Thursday. Thursday at 9 Pacific. We should have the year review broadcast. I guess it's 12 Eastern and 9 Pacific this Thursday. And then we should have at least one program before then. I'm trying to get one of the guests that was recommended from Canada, a black female. Sometime between Monday and Wednesday, just check the Black Talk Radio Network page for the date and time to see if we can work all that out. And year in review on Thursday, book club on Friday. We'll be back for the compensatory call-in next Saturday. Great to hear from everybody. I hope everyone made it through the quote-unquote holiday madness with as little stress and strain as possible. Hopefully no conflict with family members, non-white people. If you have problems, suggestions, questions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Sobriety would be best under conditions of war. Always recommend that, but certainly it would be double this time of year. You know, it's going to be an increase of enforcement officers on the road. You do not want to be behind the wheel if you are intoxicated, if you are a passenger, even if you're a pedestrian. Race soldiers, they are looking to make problems for you. You never know when you will bump into a Brian Encinia, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, John Jane Law. They will be out in full force. Be on your P's and Q's. Certainly you do not want to be around intoxicated white folks or non-white people under the influence. It can go from zero to lethal in an instant. And we already got enough problems on our plate. We do not need unnecessary strife in our lives. With that, we'll wrap things up. Thanks again for everybody participating. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Justice says hi, and we'll be back. Could be Monday. Just have to stay tuned. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.